Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Planet of Twilight by Barbara Hambly. The first to die was a midshipman named Koth Barak. One of his fellow crew members on the New Republic escort cruiser Adamantine found him slumped across the table in the Deck 9 break room, where he'd gone half an hour previously for a cup of coffee. 20 minutes after Barak should have been back to post, Gunnery Sergeant Galley Wover went looking for him, certain that he'd clicked into the infolog banks just to see if anybody mentions the mission. Of course nobody was going to mention the mission. Though Chief of State Leia Organa Solo was accompanied by the Adamantine, her journey to the Meridian Sector was an entirely unofficial one. The Rites of Sentience party would have argued, quite correctly, that Seti Ashgad, the man she was to meet at the rendezvous point just outside the Koryos systems, held no official position on his home world of Nam Koryos. To arrange an official conference would be to give tacit approval to his and the Rationalist Party's demands. Which was, when it came down to it, the reason for the talks. When Sergeant Wover saw the young man, head on the break table, eyes shut, she called to him. No response. She pecked the commander's code on the wall panel. Sir? Wover here. One of the midshipmen's down. The meds haven't gotten here yet, but... No, sir, I don't know what it is, but you might want to check with Her Excellency's flagship and let them know. Within moments, the med droids arrived and began pumping stimulants and anti-shock into the boy's veins. Wover could see the initial diagnostic lines on the screens. No virus, no bacteria, no poison. No foreign material in Koth Barak's body at all. The lines dipped steadily toward zero, then went flat. Seti Ashgad turned from the bubble of the observation viewport to regard the woman who sat coolly watchful in one of the lounge's gray leather chairs.
We have a complicated situation on Nam Koryos, Your Excellency.
We? Meaning whom, Master Ashgad? Leia Organa Solo was a petite, almost fragile-looking woman. Her relative youth would have surprised anyone who didn't know that from the age of 17 she'd been heavily involved in the rebellion, spearheaded by her father and the great stateswoman Mon Mothma. The inhabitants of Nam Koryos, or only some of them?
All of them.
Ashgad stood close to her, trying to dominate her with his height. But she looked up at him with an expression that told him she knew exactly what he was trying to do, and he stepped back.
All of us, he corrected himself. Newcomers and Therans alike.
Leia folded her hands on her knee, the wide velvet sleeves and voluminous skirts of her crimson ceremonial robe picking up the soft sheen of the lamps overhead. Once she would have remarked tartly that he was omitting mention of the largest segment of the planet's population. Those who were neither the technological post-imperial newcomers nor the ragged Theran cultists who haunted the cold and waterless wastes, but ordinary farmers. Now she gave him silence, waiting to see what else he would say. Ashgad continued in the rich baritone that so closely resembled the recording she had heard of his father.
I should explain that Nam Koryos is a barren and hostile world. Without massive technology, it is literally not possible to make a living there.
Leia looked at him skeptically. The political prisoners sent to Nam Koryos by the Grismath dynasty seem to have managed for the past 700 years.
Ah, I see Your Excellency has studied the history of the sector.
He tried to sound pleased. Enough to know that the Grismath shipped their political prisoners there in the hopes that they'd starve to death and set automated gun stations all over the planet to keep them from being rescued. I know that the prisoners not only didn't oblige them by dying, but that their descendants and the descendants of the guards are still farming the planet, while the Grisma homeworld is itself just a ball of charred radioactive waste. The only reason Leia knew this much about Namkorios was that her father had once observed that Emperor Palpatine seemed to be using the world for its original purpose, as a prison. 40 years ago, it had been rumored that the elder Seti Ashgad had been stranded on the isolated planet by agents of his political foe, then-Senator Palpatine. Those rumors had remained unproven until this second Ashgad had made contact with the Council in the wake of the squabbling on the planet and asked to be heard. "Do not meet with Ashgat," said the message that had reached Leia literally as she was preparing to board the shuttle to take her to her flagship. "Do not trust him or accede to any demand that he makes." Leia went on, "I understood that the only inhabitants of the planet before recolonization recommenced after the fall of the Empire were descendants of the original prisoners and their guards." From a corner of the lounge, in the shadow of a dark-leaved dianthus vine, Ashgad's secretary Zim smiled. Leia wasn't sure what to make of her aversion to Zim. A small brown-skinned man with his black hair drawn up into a smooth topknot. It might be the looseness of his mouth or the flattened-looking tan eyes that never seemed to blink. She forced herself to look directly at him. "Are you one of the original Koryans, Master Zim?" He said, "My ancestors were among those sent to Namkorios by the Grismaths. Yes, Your Excellency." Something changed in his eyes, becoming preoccupied as if all his attention were suddenly directed elsewhere. Ashgard went on hastily, as if covering the other man's lapse. "The problem, Your Excellency, is that 750 years of complete isolation has made the old-timer population of Namkorios into an iron-bound set of fanatical conservatives. You and I both know how that makes for superstition. One of the things my father tried to institute was a modern clinic in Wegshall. The farmers would rather take their sick to some Theran cult listener to be healed with power sucked down out of the air." He leaned forward confidingly. "It isn't only the newcomers that the Rationalist Party is trying to help, Your Excellency. It's the farmers themselves. Unless something is done to wrest control of the old Grismoth gun stations away from the Theran cultists, who forbid any kind of interplanetary trade, these people are going to continue to live like the agricultural slaves they once were. There's a strong Rationalist Party on Namkorios. And it's growing stronger. We want planetary trade with the New Republic. We want technology and proper exploitation of the planet's resources. Is that so harmful?" Leia raised an eyebrow. "The majority of the planet's inhabitants think it is." Ashgat gestured furiously. "The majority of the planet's inhabitants have been brainwashed by half a dozen lunatics who get loaded on Bruckneal route and wander around the wasteland having conversations with rocks." Leia glanced out the port, which offered a spectacular view of the ice-green and lavender curve of Bruckness Koryos, whose largest moon had been designated as the orbital rendezvous of the secret meeting. The escort cruiser Adamantine was just visible. Below it, close to the bright triangle of colored stars that were the primaries of Brocknus, Nam, and Peduceus Koryos, and pathetically tiny against the cruiser's bulk, hung the cluster of linked bronze hulls that was Seti Ashgad's vessel, the Light of Reason. Even Leia's flagship, the Borealis, dwarfed it. Assembled of such small craft as could slip singly through the watchful screens of Namkorios' ancient defensive installations, the light would barely have served as a planet hopper. It could never have taken a hyperspace jump. Hence, Leia thought uneasily, this mission. Even before she'd had the surreptitious message, their distance from the nearest New Republic bases on Doran, and their proximity to the one-time Imperial satrapy of the Anti-Meridian sector, made her nervous. Seti Ashgad paced restlessly.
"It isn't just that we newcomers are forbidden to bring in any ships larger than a personal flitter, or to let any out. The Theran habit of opening fire on any vessel over a certain size means that when equipment wears out, it can't be replaced except for an exorbitant fee. You can't pretend that's fair."
Leia spoke slowly.
I'm not saying that the Therans are right. But isn't that what colonization is all about? Gambling on what conditions are going to be when you get there? She held up a hand as the man before her drew breath for an indignant protest. What I am saying is that the Therans are supported by the majority of the population of the planet. Seti Ashgad erupted. Who are kept as their slaves by superstition and lies. That isn't the Republic's business. Namkorios is not a part of the Republic. Legally, we have no right to interfere in their affairs. Leia paused for a moment. What I will do is this. When I return to Coruscant, I'll authorize an investigation team to see what's really going on down on the planet. We may be able to negotiate with the Therans who control the gun stations. Ashgad rose.
I had hoped to convince you to come to our aid, Your Excellency. I'll certainly use all the influence I possess in the newcomer community to help your commission.
He bowed and left, accompanied by Zim, his trio of bodyguards, handsome androgynes with the oddly dead-looking hair of very expensive dolls, bowed as well. As she watched the bronze-embossed doors shut behind them, Leia heard a soft, gravelly whisper behind her.
Those three smell wrong, lady. They are no living flesh.
Leia glanced behind her at the four small, gray, wrinkled humanoids, who seemed to have melted from the antechamber's walls. The smallest, who barely topped Leia's elbow, regarded the bronze doors with narrowed yellow eyes. Several years had passed since, in the face of mounting pressure from the Council, Leia had eliminated her bodyguard of Nogri hunter-killers. There were those who said it ill-behooved her to wield a weapon that had been Palpatine's. Do not trust Ashgat, the message had said. She had sent for the Nogri secretly just before departure. There were some risks greater than schism in the Council. She answered thoughtfully, Technically, it is living flesh, though. They're synth droids, Ezrak. Sculpted synth flesh over metal armatures. They have only minimal internal computers. Their actions are centrally controlled, probably from Ashgad's ship. She frowned. Would you make sure for me that they do get on their vessel? The Nogri withdrew. They tended to keep separate from the Academy Honor Guard, who were among the few even aware of their presence on the ship. As Luke would say, there was no telling which group might be her salvation in a crisis. Do not meet with Ashgat. Down on the Borealis shuttle deck, Luke Skywalker turned the slip of flimsoplast that held that strange message over in his hands. The handwriting was Callista's. His heart was a slow battering ram against his ribs. The astromech droid R2-D2 had emerged from around the airfoil of the modified B-Wing. C-3PO, protocol droid extraordinaire, followed close behind, golden carapace shining in the soft light. 3PO announced, According to R2, all systems appear to be in flying order, Master Luke. But personally, I should be much happier were you to take a larger craft with greater oxygen capacity. Luke nodded absently. Thanks, 3PO. But his attention never left the slip of plast in his hand. He was seeing the snows of Hoth, and the way Callista's lightsaber had vied with the ice planet's dim sunlight for brightness. Remembering what it had been to fight at her side, more a part of him than his own hand. With the memories of the snow were the warm scents of night on Yavin 4, and of lying in each other's arms on the hillside above the jungles, counting stars. He hurt with wanting her, missing her, needing her. He remembered the blazing glare of the huge ships and the renegade Admiral Dalla's fleet crashing in flames. His own voice crying Callista's name, and her voice, I have my own odyssey. The message had arrived in a music box. Analysis of the peculiar crystalline dust beneath the nailheads had revealed that it had been put together on Namkorios. Callista was on Namkorios. 3PO urged Luke back to the present. Can I be of further assistance, Master Luke? According to my internal chronometers, Her Excellency's meeting with Master Ashgad should be concluding now, and you did express a desire to be away from the Borealis before Master Ashgad returns to the shuttle bay. Luke nodded. Right. Thank you, both of you. Good luck, Master Luke.
Given an estimated population of less than 1 million humans and no indigenous life forms on Nam Kurios, chances of locating Lady Callista within a standard year should be well within the 17th percentile.
Luke made himself smile. Thanks. It had been a year already since the Night Hammer had plunged blazing into the atmosphere of Yavin 4, and Callista had decided to reforge her connection with the Force on her own. Luke was turning toward the ladder that led up to the B-Wing's hatch when the main bay doors opened. His sister entered, golden boot tips flashing beneath her crimson gown. So, did he whip out an ion cannon and try to murder you?
I sympathize with his cause, but it's out of our jurisdiction.
They spoke briefly of the inconclusive meeting as Luke prepared to leave. Then he spoke softly.
Callista's got to come back. She'll stand a better chance of regaining her ability to use the Force at the Jedi Academy than she will on her own. The Jedi power still has to be within her. Kray had it. It isn't as if Callista's mind went into the body of a non-Jedi. And the Academy needs her.
Leia was silent, and he added,
I need her.
She nodded sympathetically.
You'd better go. And Luke, when you're down there, look around, will you?
According to Ashgad, the Theran cultists who control the gun stations use coercion and superstition to rule the old-timer population. If it is just superstition, there's nothing we can do about that. They voted overwhelmingly to keep the original trade restrictions in force. But if there's coercion involved, that may change the rationalist's case. Moff Gitelli still rules the Anti-Meridian sector in the name of the Emperor, so he says. If fighting breaks out between the newcomers and the Therans, he may try to interfere. We've got a pretty strong force at the Duran orbital base, but I'd rather not have to use it. I wish you could at least take R2 with you. He climbed a few rungs of the ladder up the airfoil. So do I, but even if I took him apart and tucked the pieces into every corner and under the seat of this thing, there wouldn't be room. Her last sight of the bay showed her Luke's B-Wing turning with weightless grace to the steadily burning violet eye of the distant world where Callista had taken her refuge. Alone in her private parlor, Leia idly studied an ad cube from the Lorinar Corporation Synthroid Division concerning the new droids that several members of the Council were eager to buy.
Hardly droids at all,
the pleasant voice of an obviously Synthroid announcer lauded. Suddenly, she leaned her head against the back of the chair, tired beyond words. Tired, she thought, as her hands and feet grew cold. Beyond what she should be. Every breath was an effort. The hand she tried to raise to rub the ache behind her sternum felt as if it had been manacled with lead. Dizziness swamped her. She reached across the table for the comm button, but collapsed halfway and slid to the floor. The door swished open and 3PO toddled into the stateroom, R2 close on his heels.
Your Excellency, I have been attempting to monitor fleet communications and... Your Excellency!
The stateroom door slid open again, framing the small form of Zim.
Oh, Master Zim, something terrible has happened. You must inform the emergency services.
The man walked to Leia's side, then he half-knelt and began to pull off his violet leather gloves. Again the door swished open, and Ashgad entered, accompanied by one of the fair-haired androgynous synthroids.
Zim, release her, now!
Zim's mouth turned pettishly down. Then he drew a little breath.
Very well. The action is stopped.
Ashgad picked up Leia, limp in his arms, the red velvet robes hanging nearly to the floor. To the synthroid he began to say,
You're to wait until the brig is... Yes, Lygius.
A thin, tired-looking man who was the brig's pilot stepped in.
I've launched the slave relay with the time-delayed projections of final reports for both vessels. The messages should be indistinguishable from real transmissions. Everyone on board both ships appears to be dead or incapacitated. The synth droids have taken one of the shuttles over to the escort ship.
Ashgad glanced at the wall chronometer.
Very good. It should take about 30 minutes for us to return to the Light of Reason and take her far enough from these ships for safety.
Oh, R2, do something,
cried 3PO.
We have to stop them. Guards, guards, they are kidnapping the chief of state.
The three men brushed past 3PO and R2, impervious to the droid's protestations, Leia unconscious in Ashgad's arms.
Shuttle bay,
cried 3PO, punching the code on the wall comm.
Shuttle bay, they must be stopped.
There was no answer.
Where is everyone? R2, we must get help.
The door opened as they turned to enter the anteroom. Through it, 3PO could glimpse the Nogri Ezrak, sprawled on the floor, still moving feebly, but his face livid with the pallor of approaching death. Others, human and Nogri, lay on the floor beyond. R2 directed a scanner beam over the closest body.
I know, you stupid bucket of bolts. They're all dead.
The Force was everywhere, palpable. Leia lay on a divan, on the toothed fist-sized crystals that carpeted the old sea floor plains as far as vision could descry. And she basked in the Force so much warmer than the heatless fingernail of the sun. She dreamed. She was in her father's palace in Aldera. She was presenting her children to him. Jason, Jaina, and Anakin were all grown to teenagers.
What have you taught them, these young Jedi of the House of Organa?
I've taught them to respect the rights of all living things. I've taught them that the law is above any single being's will. But we know better. Anakin spoke in the breaking treble of an adolescent, and there was an ugly grin on his face as he stepped forward. We're Jedi Knights. We have the power. His lightsaber licked out crimson and slashed her father in half. All three children had drawn lightsabers, gleaming red columns of power, making six red flames in three pairs of demon eyes. We're Jedi, Mother, said Jaina. There's no law for us. We can do whatever we want. That's your gift to us, said Anakin. We're Jedi, because you're Jedi. We are what you are. He turned to look at the pieces of Bail Organa's body. And anyway, he wasn't your real father. Leia screamed.
No! No!
The images blurred to darkness, and she heard Luke's voice.
Learn to use the Force, Leia. You have to.
Never!
You have to.
She could not move. And then, as she struggled to make sense of what was happening to her, she remembered a pilot for the rebel forces who had talked to her one night about the many substances he was addicted to. One, called Sweet Blossom, he had spoken of almost caressingly.
A little of it. Two drops, maybe. And it's like you've just woken up before your mind is in gear to do anything. You just sit around in your pajamas saying, I'll take care of business when I'm feeling a bit more the thing. But of course, you never do. Five drops is good for endless sitting, watching addercops spin webs or dust motes make patterns. Seven or eight drops, and you're paralyzed.
She heard the door lock unbolting and the rustle of clothing just beyond the line of her sight. She tried to turn her head and couldn't. Panic flooded her. Sweet Blossom, she thought. Someone was approaching the divan on which she lay. The divan's legs scraped on the permacrete floor as it was drawn backwards, away from the rectangle of sunlight that came through a tall transparasteel panel. Every atom of Leia's body struggled to rise, to fight, at least to turn her head. Zim came around the head of the divan. He stood gazing down at her. She saw that the skin of his throat was purplish-brown, shiny, and slightly articulated. Chitinous. Not like human skin at all. He walked around behind her. Lifting aside her hair, he put his hands to her neck. Something sliced her that wasn't pain and wasn't cold. More terrifying than either. She sank into darkness. As Luke touched the levers of the B-Wing and accelerated into high orbit over Namkorios, a surge of the Force washed over him. No wonder Callisto was drawn to this place, he thought. Now the planet was clearly visible. Wastes of slate, smooth and hard, stretched kilometer after kilometer. Zones of broken rock surrounded them, toothed mountains uneroded by rain or the roots of growing plants. In other places, the dry sea floors were covered for thousands of miles in faceted quartzine gravel that glared as if the world were one great cut-glass gem. Crystal mountains flashed a bleached and broken reflection in the wan light of the tiny, faded, whitish sun. He brought up the coordinates for the town of Huegshal. He would find her. He thought he would see her again. A long-range laser cannon took out his rear deflector shield and nicked the stabilizer before he was even out of sight of blackness and stars. Luke flipped into evasive action, plunging toward that glittering eternity of crystal through a flaming howl of atmosphere. A second bolt clipped the B-Wing's airfoil, and as he fought to pull out of the crazy spin, Luke saw white lances of light slash upward from the slate-gray foothills. The ground rushed upward. Blast, thought Luke as the joystick lurched under his hands. Don't quit on me now. There was enough play in the remaining stabilizer to land without killing himself, just. But when he leveled off, he'd be a better target. He zagged right, left. Dropped instinctively as a beam sliced over his head. Those were live gunners. They had to be. No auto station had that kind of response flexibility. Huge mountains yawned below him. He plunged the fighter down among them, veered through narrowing chasms. As a laser bolt splintered a black column of rock 1,000 feet high and rained the craft with fragments. The steady howling winds of the higher atmosphere turned to random hurricanes that smote him from every canyon and crevice. Luke pulled into a level slide, barely avoiding another bolt and a crag of striated quartz. The glare of the sunlight from a million mirrors nearly blinding. He put out all the strength of the force to lift the B-Wing over the last ridge of shining glass and edge it down, down. Wind slapped him like a monster hand. The B-Wing veered wildly. Then the airfoil scraped and tore on the pebbled wilderness beyond the canyon. There was an explosion of sealant and crash foam. The B-Wing rolled and came to a stop against something that sent up a cloud of fragments and dust. Here, Your Excellency. Strong hands helped Leia sit up, put a cup into hers, held it steady while she drank. How are you feeling? She blinked. The divan had been moved out onto the terrace that adjoined the room. She could see the small sun, giving only thready light in cobalt oceans of sky. Dim stars shone, even in the presence of its glow. She found that she could move her head and turn from those bizarre distances to meet the anxious, dark eyes of the man who sat at her side.
Where am I? What happened?
I'm afraid I can't tell you, Your Excellency. He sounded genuinely sorry about it.
You understand, it's better if you don't know. My name is Lygia Sarpatius Vaughn. You were Seti Ashgard's pilot, weren't you?
Zim was here.
Is this Namkorios?
Zim was here. He held the vessel away from her reaching hands, his dark brows knotting. I think you've had enough of this, Your Excellency. I'll get you some water. He emptied the cup, which Leia thought had contained water, over the low wall at the edge of the terrace. Lygia spoke gently.
Stay here, in the sunshine. I won't be a moment.
Voices rose to her from below. She recognized Seti Ashgard's.
We'd just have to go over Larm's head and talk to Demura. Larm's an idiot, anyway. He still has no concept of what we need to complete the Reliant.
Larm, thought Leia. Moff Gitelli's had an admiral named Larm. She couldn't make out the words murmured in reply, but the purring voice pierced her. Zim. Soreness lingered on the sides of her neck, but she lacked the strength to put her hands up to feel.
Ashgard answered, 3 synth droids, when I think about how much even one of those things costs.
Zim's voice was a little louder now.
It could not be helped, my lord. Synth droids were the only way we could bring the Death Seed on board the vessels undetected.
The Death Seed? Leia's breath left her as if with physical shock. Hundreds of years ago, that plague had wiped out millions.
It was the casualness of Zim's tone that galvanized her into action. She rose from the divan and made her way shakily to the far end of the terrace, perhaps 25 meters below, just above where the walls of the great rambling house merged into the harsh basalt of the bluff. Another terrace ran the length of the building. A sort of gazebo stood at one end. By the way Ashgad turned, Leia guessed that Zim sat within the gazebo's shade. A complex system of mist jets and pipes somewhat mitigated the dryness of the air. There was a third being on the terrace, stretched out on a black and orange air duvet under a veritable rain shower of air misters.
Zim's right.
It rolled over, flexed its jellied length. It was the longest hut Leia had ever seen without Jabba's obesity.
You couldn't have gotten past the medical scans without them. And only droids would have taken the vessels into hyperspace without a second jump coordinate.
Hyperspace? Leia thought in alarm. Her crew, her honor guard, 3PO and R2.
Sickness and horror swept her, replaced a moment later by a burning rage. The hut was saying,
Demura thought it was worth the expenditure. I agree with him. It wasn't enough to have Lygius put through that mission accomplished. We're leaving for Coruscant message. Or even the fake transmissions from the jump point. What do you care anyway? Demura paid for the synth droids, not you.
Ashgad turned impatiently from the railing to face the huge reclining shape.
With an attitude like that, it's no wonder you're no longer ruling this territory, Beldorian.
The hut rumbled.
Anyway, what's 300,000 credits, if you can get rid of all evidence of where Her Excellency is? Once Riakin goes into a coma, the Council's going to be chasing its tail for days, each member trying to keep the next from being named successor.
Minister Riakin, her second in command in the Council.
The hut produced a burp of cosmic proportions.
And don't speak to me about not ruling this force-benighted planet anymore. I ruled here longer than your petty empire existed, and I ruled well.
He extended one hand,
and Leia felt it. The force.
All around, the air changed as if the iridescent sunlight had become swirling, angry.
Beldorian the Hutt had been trained as a Jedi.
Leia's knees felt weak, and she retreated to the divan.
She had the Death Seed. I have to warn Riakin. I have to warn someone.
The sweet blossom drug whispered its reply.
Of course you do. But not just now.
As she lay down, something in the pocket of her robe pressed into her thigh, hard and uncomfortable. Leia frowned. Clumsy with the effects of the sweet blossom, her fingers closed on metal.
It was her lightsaber.
Leia forced herself into wakefulness. Before Lygius came back, she thought she'd better check out her room for whatever escape she could find. The air was softer indoors, modified to escape the piercing dryness. That meant magnetic shields on the doors and some kind of mist generators in the ceilings. The massive walls sheltered a sour muskiness that no air conditioning could disperse. Any place a hut occupied smelled of hut, of course. There were bugs, too. Tiny and purplish-brown, skittering along the shadows at the base of the wall. Then Seti Ashgad's voice rose again, and she returned to the terrace.
Lygius told me you'd visited her. You're to leave her alone.
She is a Jedi, Lord. I was only seeking to keep her under control.
I know what you were seeking to do. The Sweet Blossom will keep her under control without help from you. We can't take the chance of the Council naming a successor. Until everything is accomplished, let her alone.
And then?
There was a long silence. And then, we'll see. Luke hung for several minutes in the seat restraint, getting his breath. Part of his mind he stretched out to the Force, manipulating the power of fusion and heat
to keep the small impulse fuel reserves from exploding. Another part he extended, listening, probing across the harsh landscape for signs of danger. People were on their way. His mind picked up the radiant buzz of hostility. Theran fanatics, almost certainly. He couldn't get purchase on his blaster in time to free it before the weight of springing bodies rocked the fighter. Shadows fell across the gaps in the buckled hull as he snaked his arm free, sprang to his feet, and slithered through a split in the side of the tiny cockpit. Moments before, expanding gas percussive weapons echoed like thunder, and a shower of high-velocity stone pellets spattered the space where he had been. There were a lot of attackers, 20 or 25, Luke estimated, dropping to the gravel, men and women. In the sharp cold, they were wrapped in thick vests and jackets, sometimes covered by ragged burnouses. In addition to the scatter guns, they had bows, both auto bows and primitive longbows, and short javelins, and they surrounded the wrecked B-wing completely. There are 1,000 ways to use the Force in a fight, Callista's old master Jin had told her, and 1,001 ways to use the Force to avoid a fight. Luke now used something Jin had taught Callista and she him. His mind jarred the gravel underfoot, and the gravel coughed forth dust. A lot of dust. Luke launched himself out of the shelter of the B-Wing, making for the Theran speeders and riding beasts amid a roar of gunfire and a rain of projectiles. The speeders were as grubby a collection of 5th-gen makeshift junkers as Luke had seen this side of the Rebellion's worst days. Prancing and yammering among them were a dozen Koopas, brightly hued, hot-weather cousins of Tauntaun. Luke flung himself into the best-looking of the speeders and slammed it into gear. More dust bellied up, engulfing the Therans, who rushed from the first dust cloud in his direction and sprayed him with gun pellets and curses. He rode unpursued until he reached the shelter of a fantastically splintered notch somewhere near the top of the ridge. Then he saw the white flicker of a laser cannon firing skyward again. In time, their target came into view. One of the bronze mini-hulls of the Light of Reason, detached in orbit and making its way into the atmosphere. Weaving and dodging in what was clearly an extremely complex pre-programmed pattern, it streaked away to the north. In the distance, Luke could see another thread-like flash of laser brightness. 5 or 6 kilometers away, he saw what looked like the outline of ruined walls, no doubt an old Grismath prison colony. Against the translucent rose of the surrounding ground, he saw the startlingly green splotches of what he had not yet seen in all this world. Vegetation. There was water down there somewhere. He put the craft into gear and headed down the canyon. As Luke maneuvered the speeder, it sagged lower and lower and finally settled to the canyon floor. The silence was huge, like the desert silences of Tatooine. Then behind him, he heard a soft crackling and felt electricity stab the air. Turning, he saw lightning racing down the face of the cliffs like skeletal hands. He watched, fascinated, as it poured down the face of the cliffs. As it came closer, he put his mind into the Force and raised the speeder in which he sat a few feet above the ground. The lightning poured under it, jarring him even through the speeder's insulation with mild jolts of pain. At the same time, he could feel the Force, like a roaring in his mind. When the storm, whatever it was, had gone past, he let the speeder ease to the ground and stood up on it, watching the sparkling flood race down the rocks to the open plain. The planet is without life, he thought, except for scraps of vegetation and tiny enclaves of human habitation. But the Force was here. Luke dug his canteen from the speeder and the blaster he'd found along with a pair of macro binoculars under the seat and started down the canyon on foot. He sensed a human presence moments before his eyes picked out the dull metal of another speeder concealed in the shadows of a broken foundation. The owner sat in the dappled shade of a Balcrabian plant near a long ruptured pump that dribbled a series of tiny pools along the broken pavement. A young man, 6 or 7 years Luke's junior, Corellian, or maybe Alderaan stock, to judge by the brown hair, the medium build. He grinned at Luke.
Where'd you drop out of, brother? Don't tell me you're on that B-wing they brought down.
Luke grinned back ingenuously.
I just want the name of the guy who said B-wings were too small to draw their fire, that's all.
Owen Lars, he introduced to himself, holding out his hand. The young man rose.
Arvid Scraff. Something the size of a B-wing usually can get through the automatics. The Therans must have been in the base when the sensors picked you up.
Luke dipped his canteen in the water.
That's my luck. I once picked up a half a crate of glitter stem for 2,500 credits, only the guy who sold it to me forgot to tell me he'd stolen it, and it had sensor relays in it. I hadn't even cleared the atmosphere when I had 14 revenue cruisers around me like buzzflies on a ripe fruit.
It hadn't happened to him, but to Han, and it gave him credentials of a sort and a persona. More than that, it let him size up Arvid Scraff for a few moments more. Arvid picked up his own canteen.
I'll help you haul whatever's left of your ship into Ruby Gulch. You can get cash for it there.
The anemic sun was sinking fast, and harsh wind pounded them out of the west. As they were wrestling ropes to tie Luke's borrowed landspeeder to Arvid's, Luke felt something scratch on his leg. Reaching down, he pinched off a tiny insect that had begun to burrow into his flesh.
Arvid tied down a final knot and clambered over the tail fins to Luke's side. Don't waste your time on them. They're kind of gross, but they just die and get absorbed. Hell, there's stories of crystal hunters who run out of food in the barrens and stick their hands into holes so they can absorb enough drox to get energy to make it to a settlement. Not something I'd care to do myself.
He made a face.
Drox? Arvid nodded. They're everywhere. Everybody has bites. Sunlight kills them. You just keep as clean as you can and don't worry about it.
Virtually nothing remained of the B-wing. Scuff marks, charring, even the massive cylinder of the reactor was gone.
Didn't think we'd find much. Around here, everything's salvaged and sold before you can blink an eye.
A childhood on Tatooine had made Luke familiar with the economy of salvage. Conditions had been severe enough on his desert home planet, which had an open trade of sorts through Mos Eisley. On Nam Corios, a planet with virtually no natural resources and little access to imported goods, that much metal and microchips was a treasure trove. Arvid scuffed with his toe at the cracked corner of what had been a console housing.
You can stay with me at my aunt's in Ruby Gulch tonight. And Jin'll give you a top price for the speeder, too, if you want to sell. And that should be enough to get you a launch off planet when you get to Hueg Shul.
For the next hour and a half, Arvid fought the evening wind across the seafloor plains by the light of a couple of wavery chemical lamps. Against the darkness, far off light speared the sky. Luke stared.
What? Looks like an attack on the Bleak Point gun station. There's a couple of rifles under the seat, Owen, if you'd be so kind.
Luke fished out a Sinar proton blaster and a venerable Mersan Standard 4.
You take the proton, offered Arvid generously as he tromped the accelerator.
You'd probably better. The geriatric Sinar had been refitted repeatedly like every other piece of equipment Luke had seen on the planet. The gun station was a squat, dark complex of permacrete shapes seemingly fused into the black shoulder bones of the hills. The upper works of the station, where the cannon's gleaming black snout pointed at the sky, were crowned with a ragged, thorny palisade of projecting buttonwood poles, planks, and what looked like the twisted trunks of scrub locs, pointing like spears in all directions and strung with catwalks. A little band of attackers ran back and forth along the bastion, firing up into the superstructure with hard, clear bursts of proton light. Arvid put the macro binoculars to his eyes.
Yep, that's Gurney Caslow. He's one of the biggest water sellers between here and Hueg Shul. Without him, we'd never have gotten those old pump stations going again. See that gal there with the white hair? That's Yamali Darm. She ships out spook crystals, the long green and violet kind you find in clusters up in the deep hills. They make some kind of optical equipment that's supposed to make flowers grow better on worlds with K-class suns or something. She'd be the one to ask about getting yourself on a ship.
Below them, a faint cheer went up. A small group of what looked like armed farmers and townsmen scrambled onto a speeder that had been backed up to the wall. Then the speeder began to rise straight up. From the mess of timbers overhead, a rope extended. Like a plumb bob on a line, a single, lankily graceful figure in grubby crimson, tattered leather, and what appeared to be pieces of very old stormtrooper armor, rappelled casually down the face. At precisely the right moment, the defender wrapped an extra bite or two of line around one arm, and hefting a beltful of grenades in the other hand, kicked away from the wall in a long, flying parabola, coming pendulum close to the underside of the makeshift assault platform. The men on the platform fired wildly down at the form swinging toward them through the darkness. The timing was flawless. The lone defender hurled the grenades up into the speeder's undercarriage with an expert flick that tangled it with the emergency balance gear. Then the figure struck the wall and kicked off again, swooping on the end of the line back into darkness. The crew bailed out, and the speeder exploded in a rain of red-hot shrapnel. Focusing his mind through the force to pierce the darkness, Luke saw a ragged agglomerate of men and women approaching in speeders. He presumed them to be newcomers. Very few shots were fired once the two sides joined. It seemed more like an enormous brawl, men and women pulling and pushing, hitting with clubs or wrenches or hoes. They were enemies, he thought, but enemies who know they'll be meeting one another in the same food store tomorrow morning. Are those the old-timers, he guessed, and Arvid nodded sourly. Jeez, brained idiots. What business is it of theirs if we bring in ships or not? If we trade our crops for pumps and processors and transport? They can live like animals if they want to, but why make us do it? Disgusted, he shoved over the levers, back the speeder, and headed down the ridge. Luke thought, maybe because it's their planet? Over his shoulder, he saw forms standing among the struts and timbers of the gun station's superstructure, silhouetted against the glare of the lights. Among them was the thin, graceful form of the Crimson Warrior, and the lean, tiny shape of what looked like a youngish man with long braided hair. Behind them, a thin lance of coal green light stabbed straight upward from the station's main gun, losing itself in the sheer distance of the night overhead. A moment later, another light shot up from far over the hills. Tiny in the distant sky, a bright pin of fire burst. Arvid glanced quickly over his shoulder. Shit, Spawn. Something's coming in. The attackers ceased shoving and cursing. Everyone glared upward. As the gun station's cannon flared again, Arvid braked to a halt. Got one of them. Didn't get them all, though. Gurney will know what stuff came in, and what they'll be charging for it. City Ashgad's ship, thought Luke. Beyond a doubt, the attack on the gun station had been coordinated to improve the populist leader's chances of a safe return. Arvid brought the speeder in closer, overtaking the retreating clumps of combatants. Some distance from the gun station, Luke saw a line of immobilized old speeders. The newcomers were clamoring into them. One man called out, "That you, Arvid?" And an elderly woman's voice added, "Where you been, child? And where'd you get that speeder?" "Belongs to Owen here, Aunt Jen." Arvid waved at Luke. "He, took it in trade for an injury." Luke introduced himself, keeping up the story he had told Arvid, that he was a speeder mechanic on his way to Huegshul. "What was that all about?" he asked, referring to the skirmish. A heavyset man with a beard like a banta in malt made an angry gesture. "We just got sick and tired, that's all. We got word a planet hopper was sending in a shipment of chips and droid parts, and them motherless Therans were out to blast them because that brady-haired listener of theirs told them droids were against nature or something." The woman Arvid had pointed out as Yumali Darm moved over to the side of the bearded man's skimmer. She was trim and pretty, with an ion cannon slung casually on her shoulder. "This was serious," she said. "About 6 hours before the attack, there was, I don't know what. I've heard the old-timers talk about force storms, and this must have been one of them. Weirdest thing I've ever seen. Every tool came flying off the bench, whirling around the room like a cyclone, boxes of crystals heaving and jumping off the shelves. They don't think Knapsacker's gonna pull through, he was burned so bad." 6 hours before the attack on the gun station, Luke thought. The very hour he had used the Force to get himself away from his attackers. He had caused the Force storm. Han Solo barely glanced up at Chewbacca. Nothing. He looked at the chronometer. It was a few hours after noon, the bright, misty daylight of the resort moon Hesperidium already losing its strength. There was no possible way he could continue to deceive himself. Leia was late. Very, very late. Chewbacca hauled himself out of the terrace pool and shook, spattering water in all directions. Behind him, among the realistically engineered rocks, Winter glided fish-like with the giggling twins, while Anakin padded solemnly all around the pinkly glowing field of his confinement bubble. The small villa that had housed a succession of the Emperor Palpatine's concubines had been thoroughly swept for listening devices before Leia and her family came for an ostensible vacation on what was arguably the most beautiful moon of the Coruscant system. But Han still felt easier talking on the terrace. Speaking more to himself than to Chewbacca, he muttered, "She should have listened to Callista." In his heart, of course, he knew that Leia couldn't have heeded the warning. The rationalist party had spent too many months setting up the secret meeting with Ashgad and had too much influence both in the New Republic and in the various fragments of the old Empire for the whole matter to be jettisoned at the last minute on the strength of an anonymous note. Leia also had to consider that, though Moff Gatellis of Anti-Meridian was in no position militarily to go against the Republic fleet in the Meridian sector, it was too much to hope that he would not find some way of turning disaffection on that world to his advantage. That was the problem, reflected Han, with power. All Leia could do, when Callista's message had reached her, was include her Nagri bodyguard in the party and run the risk of the hideous scandal that would result if they were discovered. Every precaution that could be taken had already been taken. "She should have run," he said aloud this time. A pleasant voice announced, "Two visitors in the vestibule, Commander Solo. They have declined to present credentials. Would you like them to be admitted, or would you prefer an observation first?"
"Admit them."
Han hated spying on his guests. If they came in the door shooting, he and Chewie could probably deal with the situation. Mon Mothma, guiding spirit of the rebellion and former chief executive of the provisional government, held her hands close to the iron fender of the hearth, and the flame outlined her fingers in amber light. Her guard, a gloomy-looking young man whose expression never altered, no matter what was done or said around him, sat nearby. Mon Mothma said,
"The entire mission has disappeared."
Something within Han's ribcage went still and cold.
"Disappeared?"
Mon Mothma nodded.
"We're keeping the news quiet for as long as we can. The matter is complicated by the fact that Minister of State Riakan has fallen gravely ill. At first we were afraid it might be related to the plague that has been reported in the Meridian sector, but..."
"Plague?"
Mon Mothma sighed.
"Reports are too fragmentary, to be sure. We can't get med teams in because of the revolt that has broken out on Yuren. Local factions have the base under siege. What is more, we haven't heard anything of Leia's flagship or its escort after they reported the meeting acceptably concluded and entered hyperspace at the scheduled jump point. Might someone alter a jump point by remote? Reroute them?"
Han shook his head. "Not possible. Yeah, I'm not a scientist or anything, but those Navicomputers are shielded like a Valorzian harem against every kind of solar flare and gamma particle for just that reason."
They sat in silence save for the flickering of the fire. Han said at length,
"I'll get in touch with Lando. We have to keep this small."
Mon Mothma held out a red plast cube.
"These are the final reports from Leia and from her crew, and the sensor readings on Ashgad's ship."
Han escorted her to the vestibule. At the door, Mon Mothma turned to him.
"You be careful."
Han gave her a grin.
"Your Excellency, the day I start being careful is the day I buy myself a foot warmer and a rocking chair. I'll find her."
You Molly Darm pecked through a command on the ramshackle keyboard, then turned to Luke.
There. 8.5 months ago, on Buon Neb's run in from Durin. One human passenger, female, 175 centimeters tall. She's the only human female that height all year. Cleared Port Authority under the name Cray Mingla.
That's her. Luke's whole body tingled with grief and joy.
No occupation listed, though in Hueg Shoal... Ah, drat.
The screen fuzzed out. The hair at Luke's nape prickled, and turning quickly toward the window, he saw the racing blue tentacles of ground lightning pouring across the gravel, writhing between the pylons on which the newcomer houses were built for just this purpose. Yamali got up and crossed to the open door.
Not a big one. It'll pass in about 10 minutes.
They stood together in the doorway, watching the electricity race under the pilings of the house.
What are they? Asked Luke.
Yamali shrugged and twisted her white hair up more firmly into its wooden combs.
They seem to start either in the mountains or from those crystal chimney formations. Sills, the old-timers call them, out on the wastelands. I've been caught in them 6 times out prospecting. It's like being knocked down and having your bones polished from the inside, and you're sick for 1.5 days. After that force storm the other day, these don't look so bad.
The walls and furniture of Yamali Darm's little dwelling, like every other building Luke had been in since his arrival in Ruby Gulch last night, bore the marks of the maelstrom of lightning activity that had swept over them at the very hour, Luke guessed the very minute, he had drawn on the power of the Force to confuse and distract the Theran raiders. He had done that. The thought made him sick with guilt. Luke was silent, thinking about what he had done.
Do the old-timers ever talk about there being some kind of beings living on this world? Invisible, maybe, or hidden back in the mountains? Something that may be causing this?
Yamali Darm chuckled.
Bless you, Pilgrim, this planet was surveyed 6 ways from next week by the Grismiths before they ever dropped a soul here. I've been darn near all over this rock and never saw and heard a thing. Even the listeners will tell you there's nothing out there.
In the doorway, the tall synth droid bowed to Leia.
Beldorian the Splendid sends his compliments, Your Excellency. He would be honored by your presence at tea.
Will Master Ashcat be present?
Leia exaggerated the haziness of her voice. She had been drinking only a minute amount of the sweet blossom-tainted water, pouring most of the liquid over the side of the terrace in an effort to clear her system of the drug. She had mostly succeeded in combating the sweet blossom's effects, but was left seriously dehydrated in the harsh, dry climate. The fact that no one had come in to make her drink the drugged water had told her that the room wasn't wired.
I do not know, Your Excellency.
Ligeus had told her that she must stand in the sunlight for 15 minutes every day at noon. She suspected it had something to do with combating the effects of the illness. From her post on the terrace, she'd counted at least 5 synth droids. At least 2 bore marks of necrosis, the slow dying of the flesh that covered their metal armatures. Leia changed into her heavy ceremonial robe, and as the synth droid led her to the hut, she took care to note the layout of the house. There were iron blast doors standing open at the bottom of a flight of steps, and through them she glimpsed a vast compound like a docking bay looking out over the plateau edge. A blocky, medium-sized freighter stood there, synth droids moving around it, carrying what looked like the components of a computer core, which meant that construction was fairly far along. As Leia was ushered around a corner and down another flight of steps, the smell of hut rose to meet her.
Beldorian shifted his enormous python-like bulk on the dais of air duvets and cushions. Unlike many of his species, he favored gold rings in his folds of fat and on his fingers, and a jeweled stud in his lower lip. On a baldric of gold and reptile leather, he wore his lightsaber.
It is dreadfully slow here, little princess, dreadfully slow. You must find the days weigh heavy in your room.
They do, a little, admitted Leia, wondering what all this was leading up to.
Master Ashgard has been very assiduous about seeing to my wants.
Oh, and to mine too, mine too,
Beldorian replied.
Not that I'm in anywhere near the same position as yourself, but, well, I have my comforts, of course, and my chef. Though, quite frankly, little princess, this new fellow's not the cook Zubindi Ebsuk was. Zubindi.
He sighed and groped around in a porcelain washtub of brandy for the spiky balls of marinated prabkros that floated there.
Now, there was a chef. I was desolate when he died. Grant me the right hormones, the right enzymes to inject, he used to say, and I will transform a sand flea into the center course of an imperial feast. And he could, you know.
She felt the touch of his mind on hers.
Ashgard, now. He's made himself the champion of these newcomers. But what is that? When I ruled Wegshul, all the people came to me with their problems. Ashgard couldn't have taken over if I hadn't been tired. All that fighting with that Tasselda woman. Now, taste this, little one.
He extended his hand, and across the room a plate of beaten silver stirred on the sideboard, then floated across to them. It contained roulades of some sort, surrounding a bed of what smelled like petroleum byproducts, topped with a weird blue thing like an enormous berry. Who was Tasselda? She asked, handing him the plate.
A former colleague.
He plucked the berry from the top of the dish.
She and I came to this world together, many years ago. But she grew jealous of the reverence in which the local population held me, and of my greater skills. She couldn't even manufacture the basic tools of our order. Now, tell me if this is not the most exquisite taste in the galaxy.
Leia cut a section from the berry, and watched as Beldorian slurped down the rest with Rabelaisian enthusiasm before she ate her own fragment. It was delicious. Beldorian's eyes held hers again.
Now a young lady of your talents might find herself needing allies in a situation like this. Ashgard can't be trusted, you know, little one.
A voice said quietly, At least he never sold one of his slaves to Dzim. Nigeus stood in the doorway. Beldorian swung around, hissing,
Have a care, philosopher.
The whole length of him twitched, the great 7-foot tail creeping back and forth like a separate angry being as his red eyes narrowed.
Upon another occasion, I told you, I do not brook interference.
Nigeus came forward again and took Leia by the hand. What did he offer you, my dear? Partnership in ruling this planet? Or just that he'd let you free if you'd put him back in charge. He raised Leia to her feet and led her to the door. Beldorian made no move to stop them, but as Ligeus reached to touch the opener plate, the hut gestured pettishly in his direction. Ligeus gasped as if struck, half doubled over in agony, his free hand going to his temple. He was ashen with shock and pain as Leia slapped the opener plate and led him through. Migraine. Nigeus managed, through lips drained of color. He does that. Sometimes. Sometimes worse. As they made their way to the stairs, Nigeus urged, Don't trust him, my dear. He couldn't protect you from Dzim, and he could not defeat Ashgard. Even years ago, when Ashgard first reached this planet, Beldorian was no match for him. Leia looked up, startled. But the original Ashgard... Ligeus looked away, and she could see that he'd said more than he meant. He ushered her gently into her room, and stepping quickly out, closed the door between them. The only conclusion she could draw was that the man who claimed to be the son of Seti Ashgard was himself Emperor Palpatine's old rival for senatorial power. Was, in fact, Seti Ashgard himself. The house Luke sought lay deep in the heart of the old-timer quarter. Broken pipes crossed the dirty white stucco of the walls. A few desiccated stumps clung to niches overgrown with snig vine, like almost everything else in the grubby old-timer quarter. The door opened before he knocked on it. The woman standing on the low slab of crystal was of indeterminate age. Luke knew she wasn't young, in spite of the porcelain perfection of her face. Her hair was raven black and hadn't been washed in weeks. Neither had her trim, high-breasted, long-legged body, or the dingy green dress that wrapped it.
Welcome.
She drew him into the dense shadows within the first of the house's many rooms.
I am Tethelda of the Knights.
Her eyes met his, jeweled blue under flawless brows.
But then, you knew that.
Luke looked around. Most of the transparasteel had been boarded shut, and the room was illuminated only by a string of old-fashioned glow bulbs tacked to the ceiling. His heart went out to her in compassion. She had been here for who knew how long, unable to use her powers for fear of harming the innocent in a force storm.
I'm called Owen, he said. And I'm looking for someone.
Ah.
The blue eyes smiled. She crossed to a cupboard and took out a pair of goblets, old Corellian glasswork, tulip-shaped and very valuable. She flicked a drop off the base of one. Luke saw that the cupboard skittered with them. She poured wine.
Callista. You've seen her?
His whole being was a shout of triumph.
How not? I am her teacher now, in the ways of the Force.
The wine was from Durin, and not very good, but Luke sipped it, his eyes on the woman before him.
Where is she? Can you take me to her? Of course. I have been waiting for you since she spoke your name.
Tethelda took both of his hands in hers.
There's a cave in the hills, not far from here. The Force is strong there. It's one of the places where the ground lightning emerges. I sent her there to meditate. I'll take you. Have you a speeder?
He nodded. I have to get it fixed, but I can do that in a day or so.
And weapons?
He touched the blaster and the lightsaber at his belt. Tesselda's face fell.
It isn't enough. We will have to wait.
Luke felt a twang of panic.
Wait? What's the problem?
Tethelda shook her head with the air of one not wishing to burden a friend with her troubles.
It's nothing.
Can I help?
I couldn't ask you to. It's my affair alone.
Tell me, please. Her smile was shy and a little self-deprecating.
It's been a long time since I had a champion. Your Callista is lucky, Owen. It's an old story, my friend. When first I came to this world, I only intended to accomplish the minor mission the Masters of the Jedi had ordered for me, and to depart. But seeing the way the people lived, squabbling endlessly over pump rights and who was entitled to grow which crops on which piece of land, I could not leave. I lent such talents as I possessed to the side of the people. With my lightsaber in hand, I led them to a stronger and more peaceful way of life. After the fighting was over, these people made me their ruler, and I was happy.
Luke nodded, seeing in his mind this beautiful woman in her warrior youth. She went on,
but many years later, another Jedi came to this world, an evil creature, Beldorian, he was called. He was not strong in the Force. He worked through violence, lies, and calumny, until everything I had done here was given a sinister significance. My friends turned against me.
Beldorian was too feeble an adept to manufacture his own lightsaber, so he stole mine.
Well, it was inevitable that he should succumb to his vices. He was ousted many years ago by Seti Ashgard. Ashgard took from him his very house and all the treasure inside it. Treasure which he had stolen from me.
Her voice became somber.
And most importantly, somewhere in that house is my lightsaber.
Luke said softly.
Ah.
She looked at him sadly.
We will be vulnerable when we go to the cave to find your Callista. Ashgard's servants are merciless. The more so because they are no longer human, but only human-seeming droids.
Luke grinned at her. He felt light and buoyant, as if his bloodstream were filled with fire. I'll get your lightsaber for you. We'll be out of town by nightfall. Tethelda smiled softly at him.
She told me I could trust you, Owen. I saw the light in her eyes when she spoke your name. Callista.
Luke's whole body seemed to be singing as he strode down the ill-paved back streets of the old-timers' town.
I found her. I found her.
His steps slowed. When she spoke your name, Tasselda had said. But Callista would not have known that he would be calling himself Owen Lars. He stopped and realized he had missed his way among the near-identical white houses, and he thought there was something in the wine. Tasselda was using him. He turned his steps back towards her house and saw her through the back door across the grubby yard. She was groping for something behind furniture and under cushions. She faced him, her blue eyes wide and furious, and he felt her mind pull on his, felt the weak, diffused shoving of the force. Then she began pulling drocks off her arm and eating them with her broken teeth. Luke turned away. It was less the force than his years with the rebellion that made him pick up almost instinctively the sense of danger, and only in the next second the sound of running feet. He ducked as a spear buried itself in the dirt just beyond where he'd stood. Someone hurled a rock, and he sprang back as an old-fashioned sodium blaster bolt ripped a charred line in the wall at his side. Luke could have scattered them with a blast of the force, but he dared not. A girl of no more than 16 ran at him with a club, and he swept it aside with his forearm and fled down an alley. The little gaggle of old-timers ran after him, cursing and shaking their weapons.
"Here now, what's all this?"
bellowed a voice. The old-timers skidded to a halt. An 8-foot Arthurian in the blue uniform of the Hwaeg Sol Municipal Police came walking down the alley.
"Shame on the lot of you,"
warbled the hammerhead.
"What do you think you are? Nothing?"
There was a muttering among the old-timers. Someone dropped a rock she'd had in her hand. Someone else said something about the evil one.
"Yeah, well, mobbing a man who didn't even fire a blaster he's carrying doesn't sound like evil to me, sugar. Get out of here, the bunch of you, before I run you all in for disturbing the peace."
The Arthurian officer turned to Luke as the crowd dispersed.
"You okay?"
"I'm fine. Crazy Therans."
"Not Therans. These are the ones who attacked Master Ashgard's house. I suspect they're the ones who killed the last of his human servants early this year, though I can prove nothing. I know it was they who kidnapped that young woman."
Luke felt as if he'd been kicked in the chest. "Young woman?" The Ithorian regarded him for a moment, speculation in its golden eyes.
"She called herself Cray, but forgot on a number of occasions to answer when spoken to by that name. She was dragged away one night, but before I could find where they took her, I encountered her in the street. She said they were her friends."
Luke spoke through dry lips. "Have you seen her?"
"She left Hwaeg Sol within a week of her arrival, of her own will, so far as we know."
Han Solo swung down the ladder from the observation port and crossed to Lando Calrissian station at the long-range scanners. "Okay, what do we got?" Lando flicked a calibration switch on the console of the Millennium Falcon and studied the image of the wreck far below.
"It's big enough to be the Adamantine. By the heat streak in the atmosphere, they've been down there for about 10 hours.
Planetfall was a nightmare. The atmosphere was a whirling rack of storms, and the Falcon was buffeted like a plastine plate in a riptide. Han and Chewbacca worked side by side over the console as the sensors began to pick out the debris on the ice below. The serial numbers showed that the ship, wedged into a chasm and locked in ice, was the Corbantes. Not the Adamantine, not the Borealis, not Leia. Han didn't know whether to feel relief or despair. Leaving Lando at the Falcon's controls, Han and Chewie suited up and went out. Hanging on for dear life against the butcher winds that obscured the faceplates of their E-suits with flying ice and let themselves down the frozen cliff toward the wreck. Han yelled into the helmet mic, "Small craft!" He pointed at the burn marks that scored the hull. "That's darn heavy guns for a planet hopper, even if you could get one out this far." The crew they found in the outer holds were dead, lying under white mounds of frost and ice. Radiation warning lights were on all over the ship. Further inward, they found those who had survived, barely, by crouching near the fading heat of the reactors in a bid to outlast the cold until rescue could arrive. 17 of them were still alive among twisted heaps of the dead. 2 more died while Han and Chewie went through the agonizing process of loading them onto antigrav tables and struggling up the cliffside to the Falcon. They rigged life support equipment in holds originally stocked with the smuggled glitter stem and rock ivory that had been Han's stock in trade years ago. Lando guided the bucking, healing freighter up through the insanity of the atmosphere again.
Where do we take them?
Bag shows, probably our best bet. The medical facility's there and a small base. At least we can check out enemy movements in this sector. I didn't see signs of heavy artillery, but it takes more than just a couple of planet hoppers to put out a cruiser. Psst. Something hit the Falcon like the zap of a live wire. Han gave a yelp of protest and dove for the control panel even as the impact hurled him off his feet.
Where are they coming from? There's nothing out there,
screamed Lando. Another laser beam caught the shields and overload lights went on over the main console. There was nothing on the targeting screen. Han was already scrambling up the ladder to the gunnery turret. Lando's voice yelled in his earjack.
You see them?
Han saw. They were like microscopic dust on the monitor. Each was about the bulk of a laser cannon, barely large enough to accommodate a pilot. The stars veered wildly as Lando evaded. Against the black of space, Han saw only a quick gleam through the turret port. Whatever they were painted matte black and bore no lights at all.
Blast it! They're everywhere!
Han got off a scattering of shots, but it was like trying to hit gnats with a smash ball club. Another hit, and the thin patch in the shield registered as a hole. Lando flipped and swerved to cover the open shield. Han hoped those guys in the hole were strapped in tight.
Drones!
He shouted.
You can't send a drone through hyperspace, and that's no drone shooting.
A blast of white at the corner of Han's eye told him the miniature ships had taken out part of the Falcon's upper structures. Were they ships at all, thought Han? What did they have in there, little guys the size of his thumb?
I'm going to clear us a path. Straight through 7x6, bearing 0. Punch it on 3. I don't know, buddy, what... Do it!
At the same moment, Han hit every 4 cannon he had. Columns of white destruction flowing out in an almost continuous burst. Like a piton chasing its shadow, the Falcon followed the white path of light. As Han calculated by feel rather than instrumentation when the last possible moment would be to jump without hurling themselves into their own fire. The little toothpick ships came pouring back in the wake of the blast, firing at the now steady target following the light. Han counted. 1, 2, this had better work. The last of the shields went in a flare of white. 3! Lando hit it, and the stars stretched into lines of white. You find your friend? Luke raised his head from the valves he was cleaning and grinned at Yamali Darm. He wasn't surprised to see her. Arvid had told Luke when he'd recommended him for the job as mechanic at Kroeg's Fix-It Barn that it was the biggest repair shop in Hueg Shoal, which meant on the planet. What can I do for you?
I wanted to ask your boss if I could bring in the skid after I unload it. We're sending a shipment up tonight, or trying to. Lorinar's got a pickup cruiser in high orbit.
Lorinar? Luke was suddenly curious. You sell the crystals to Lorinar Corporation? The way Arvid had spoken, he'd gotten the impression that Darm's was a small-time operation, digging in the desert for crystals to make some kind of obscure optical equipment useful only to university research labs. Lorinar was anything but small-time. Darm dug in the pocket of her vest and fished out a hunk of crystal. Smokies, we call them, or spooks. See what happens when I hold it up to the light? Luke looked. See those gray lines in it? Now watch. She carried it to where the recharger crouched like a greasy metal monster in the corner. Gingerly, she pulled out a recharger block, set the terminals against the crystal, and thumbed the switch. Luke flinched as the disturbance in the force axed his brain. Darm didn't appear to feel anything. When he recovered, he took the crystal from Darm's hand and held it to the window again. the thread-like gray striations had changed their orientation, forming two star-like blotches where the terminals had touched. The prospector grinned. They can program them, realign the structure to act as a receiver. She glanced at him more closely. Are you okay, Owen?
Yeah. Luke rubbed his temples, trying to gather his wits. Yeah, I'm fine.
No wonder the planet reverberated with the force, he thought. Could these crystals be used to... Jarm went on. There's a meeting tonight. Seti Ashgad's back. Turns out he met with some bigwig in the Republic. We're all going to his place, that big old joint that used to belong to some hut way long ago. If your friend's still in settled territory at all, someone will have seen her. Ashgad's palace, though typical of hut dwellings in its burrow-like arrangement of rooms leading out of rooms, round doors, and feeding niches in every available wall, had been in human ownership long enough to have had windows put in, and it had been cleansed many times. Synth droids guarded the door to the palace. He doubted that most of the people in the room realized that the guards weren't human. When Luke entered the house with Arvid and Aunt Jin, he reached out with his mind, calling Callista's name, searching for some trace of her. But whether because of her loss of ability to use the Force, or because of the strange, thick presence of the Force in the ether of the planet, or simply because she was not and had never been here, he felt nothing. Gurney Caslow jostled over to them through the crowd.
Arvid, we're looking for a couple of boys for a job. There's a drop coming in tomorrow night.
Arvid leaned forward. Where?
10 Cousins.
Luke had heard Kroeg speak of the place. The cousins were sills. Crystal chimneys standing in a ring, markers of some unknown geological process.
Caslow studied Luke. We can use as many as possible. I hear it's a good-sized cargo.
The lights dimmed. A curtain at the back of the room parted, and Seti Ashgad stepped through. As he began to speak, Luke thought how the sun had the same easygoing charm and quick promises that he had witnessed in hollows of Ashgad's father, who must be in his 80s now.
Now, we can't have any of that,
Ashgad was saying to a raucous suggestion that Republic troops would soon be on hand to settle for the Therans.
They're the majority, after all. It's their planet.
Gurney Caslow sprang to his feet.
It's our planet, too. We bust our backs putting plants on this motherless rock. Don't that count? I thought so.
Ashgad swept the crowd with a green eye, suddenly cold and angry.
I was optimistic enough to assure you I could do something about that. It appears I was wrong.
Silence fell, but Luke felt anger pass like ground lightning through the crowd. Ashgad went on.
Perhaps I should let Her Excellency Leia Organa Solo tell you in her own words the result of our meeting.
The light in the chamber dimmed further, and the hollow of Leia appeared. It was of crystal clear quality. The heavy folds of her robe of state spread around her. Nearby, Nogri bodyguards squatted on their hunkers, nearly a dozen strong. Leia's chin was up, and she spoke with a cold precision.
I'm afraid that any help from the Republic is out of the question, Master Ashgad. Too many people see the efforts of the rationalists on your planet as disruptive, unruly, and criminal.
A buzz stirred the crowd. Beside Luke, Gurney Caslow muttered,
I'll show you, criminal, honey.
Leia's image went on.
And quite frankly, the discontent of a handful of settlers on a world that isn't even a member of the Republic is not worth the 2 billion credits it would cost. Not to mention the damage done to the Republic's image, should we intervene in your quarrel.
The crowd cried out angrily. Luke seethed, knowing that to protest that the Hollow was a fake would only reveal his own identity. For one thing, Leia never appeared in public with the Nogri. For another, Luke saw when she rose that the chair she had been sitting on was nothing like those in the Borealis conference room. A good slicer could get a hollow of Leia's face and alter the movements of the lips to mesh with any voter-modified script. But the people in the room believed what they saw, and they were furious.
Under pouring rain, the port of Bagshell on the planet Nimdrovus crawled with troops. Han had alerted the med center that he had 15 critical cases on board. Izum Ulos, the Hoden physician he'd talked to, awaited him in the docking bay with an emergency team. Surrounded by a squad of uniformed Drovians, who seized Han's arms the minute he came down the Falcon's ramp, shoved him up against the wall, and searched him none too gently.
Is this really necessary?
Demanded Dr. Ulos indignantly. Han also expressed himself to the head of the Drovian squad, one Sergeant Nizik Sralpixor, along the same lines, but with considerably greater emphasis.
Doc, if you'd seen some of the armaments coming in for the Gopswo tribes, you wouldn't be asking that.
Dr. Ulos ducked his tentacled head as he accompanied Han, the sergeant, two troopers, and the med team back up the ramp.
You must excuse us. The Gopswo have been restless for months, ancestral enemies of the Drovians.
The Drovian sergeant grabbed Han's arm.
Those Malt spawn killed my family, see?
The Hoden informed Han gently.
It's necessary that they be permitted to search the ship. With local unrest as violent as it has been, and with 40 deaths from the plague so far on the Republic base...
Aghast, Han stared up at the willowy form towering over him.
40?
I fear so. It's why I questioned you so closely before I was permitted to give you medical clearance. That, combined with Gopswo raids on the suburbs, has made the atmosphere here terrible.
Han followed the physician into the next hold. What's going on? People down with the plague here? We get attacked by something I've never seen anywhere? A partisan revolt on Durin? He gestured at the forms of the Corbantis crew. And somebody sure shot down these poor guys. Dr. Ulos and his team passed swiftly from victim to victim, injecting anti-shock and stabilizers, transferring them to stasis boxes on anti-grav tables. Through the open boarding ramp, the sound of shots could be clearly heard. Han ducked back onto the bridge and motioned to Lando. I'm going to find out... Shots could be clearly heard. Han ducked back onto the bridge and motioned to Lando. I'm going to find out what's going on out there. Don't take the engines all the way down. If I haven't linked with you by then, take off and find Leia. Whatever it costs. After Her Excellency had been kidnapped, R2 and 3PO's distress signals had been answered by a smuggler who had taken them as far as Bagshow. Now he and R2 were in a tap cab entertaining customers in hopes of earning passage to the fleet orbital base at Psi-Block 12 on Durin to share the awful news of the princess's abduction with the proper Republic authorities. Given the capabilities of a high-quality protocol droid to reproduce languages, complete with inflections and tonalities, C-3PO could duplicate nearly any of the 30,000 songs popular in the core worlds over the past 75 standard years. One patron, a Chadra fan, piped up,
Can you play Mundogreen's Fugue in K?
Naming a classical piece of great grandeur. It was one of 3PO's favorites. But the swelling strains of the fugue had the effect of emptying the bar of all customers still clear-headed enough to walk. At the conclusion of 3PO's performance, the barkeep made her way over to him, the diamond rings through her snout twinkling in the bar's dim light.
Your boys ain't half bad. Your boss going to be by here later? Maybe he and I could work out a deal.
Oh, we don't have a boss, madam. Our master is...
Now don't confuse the poor lady, Threezy.
He turned to the barkeep.
Their boss is a buddy of mine on the Antimeridian route. He hates to have even his droids call him boss.
The Chadra fan hustled the two droids out the door, speaking under his breath.
You want to end up playing Sparklebop at this meat market for the next 35 years? She's trying to steal you.
3PO squeaked,
What? Steal us?
Once they were in the rain-slicked street, the Chadra fan introduced himself.
Yabuk Yim. Reporter for the Trinebulan News. Where is your boss?
My counterpart and I are the property of... R2, what are you doing?
The little astromech swung sharply around, banging his golden counterpart. After considerable thought that fortunately took place so quickly as to give the remark the promptness of truth, 3PO explained,
Our master is waiting for us on Psi-Block 12. It is vitally important that we get there with the utmost speed.
Psi-Block 12, eh? There's been no word out of there for 30 hours. Now the talk around the bars here is that somebody's supplying the Gopsuo with weapons and promising them the guard stations on the roads are going to be down. And now they are. We've got to get off this festering mud ball.
There was another crescendo of mayhem. Yarbov shifted the small recording device he wore to the front of his belt and scampered in the direction of the commotion. A moment later, combatants came pouring out of the narrow street that ran alongside a large central canal. A knot of uniformed Drovians and a couple of humans, all defending themselves against a much larger contingent of differently uniformed Drovians whose shaved crania bore topknots in which animal totems of colored plastic and rubber had been braided.
Good gracious! Exclaimed the protocol droid. Artu, that's Captain Solo!
Heavily armed, the Gopsuo clansmen ran from their tenements with new weapons in their hands, shouting the names of their murdered ancestors and the 25 personifications of virtue, and firing on their oppressors and anyone they associated with their oppressors. Beside Han, Sergeant Rao Pixar growled,
"Stinking scum toes! You better be proud of your handiwork, Solo."
Han flattened against an alley wall to return fire.
Me? Proud? I never even heard of Nimdrovus until last week.
Pixar went on.
Republic will send troops, they said. No need to have big standing armies. Well, we sent for troops, pal, and they ain't here.
He cursed as laser fire clipped the back of his tentacle. Han thumbed the toggle on his comlink.
Mando! We're on our way back. The Gopsuo are overrunning this whole sector. Have the Falcon ready for liftoff.
3PO called out,
Captain Solo! Captain Solo!
But his words did not carry over the shriek of the blasters. Even as 3PO was trying to ascertain how to get through the Gopsuo, Solo and the Drovians disappeared at a run down the narrow street.
The docking bays, Artu, you're a genius. Of course that's where they'll be going.
They reached the docking bays only moments after the advancing Gopsuo closed in. Blaster fire splattered among the wide, sheltered concrete pads. In places, the Drovian troops had set up ion cannons, driving the Gopsuo back or holding them to the few pads they'd managed to take over. 3PO cried,
"There!"
as they emerged into the sheltered cargo porch and saw the familiar shape of the Millennium Falcon crouched, entry ramp down. A spattering of blaster fire tore up the pavement before them. Two troops of natives held the two entrances to the bay. Those under the same porch as R2 and 3PO were unfortunately the Gopsuo, a ragged assemblage of guerrilla fighters armed to the teeth with the finest of weaponry. The Drovians under the other porch were fewer in number, but 3PO could distinguish Captain Solo among them.
Captain Solo, it's us! Don't leave us!
More laser fire drowned his voice. Solo broke cover, dashed across the open pavement in a light storm of covering fire, and plunged up the boarding ramp. The ramp started to lift the moment his feet touched its end. It gulped him up like a steel monster slurping up a treat.
Don't leave us!
The souped-up freighter tore a hole in the rain-black clouds and was gone. Luke saw the six speeders round the corner into the yard of the Blue Blurred Cafe. A couple of volunteer guards rode Koopas behind them, blaster rifles slung in the ready position, faces blacked and eyes glittering in the watery flicker of the stars. Gurney Caslow approached and tossed Luke a small flat can of the dark camouflage paint that hunters use to take the glint off their weapons.
"Fourth in line," he whispered. "Rendezvous at Ashgad's if we get split up."
Luke blacked his face and touched up the crude pair of infrared goggles Aunt Jin had lent him. Ashgad was putting out a lot of money to get himself in the position of leader of the ruling faction of the planet, he thought. Still, he felt there was some piece of information he didn't have that would make sense of this. Ahead, he saw the spark of laser cannon illuminate the spine of the hills. As if in answer, another glinted 60 degrees beyond the horizon. Before them, the loose ring of the crystalline cousins pointed at the stars. Tiny in the hard black vault overhead, a pin light exploded, faded. Someone cursed the Therans.
Luke slowed his newly repaired speeder as a flicker far up in the sky signaled a minute capsule of smuggled goods. Caslow marked where the capsule came down, every driver triangulating on the 10 icy pinnacles. And they raced for them over the vast dish of the plain. Men were handing crates up out of the pit, passing them to the drivers. A flurry of shots in the distance told Luke of approaching Therans, held off by the ragged perimeter of guards. Someone gave him a bale of blaster rifles, which he stowed in the back of his speeder. They were passing rifles up singly now. He caught one, held it in the dim glow of the speeder's console lights to see the make. On the butt was the silver coating plate of the New Republic Honor Guards. The gun had come off the Borealis. Leia's ship. For the first time in days, Leia had awakened with her mind clear. Ashgad had left that morning to spend 3 days in Hueg-Shul, and the water Lygias had brought her had been clean. Whether that had been an oversight or a gift to her, she knew she had to take advantage of it without delay. She drank it all the moment she realized it wasn't drugged. I have to escape, she thought. In her mind, she cried out, Luke! Sending the word out across the emptiness of air and crystal and early light.
Luke!
But the force only filled her with the alien sense of its presence. It was like the sound of the sea drowning all other voices in its great voice. She returned to the bedchamber and sat on the end of the divan. They had released the death seed. If they could control it, or thought they could control it, through Zim, it was an easy guess what the negotiations with Moff Gitellis and Admiral Larm were about. Curse them, she thought. Zim was somehow a key. He could lay the plague on them, transmitted by the synthroids, and call it off as he had called it off her. She remembered the ecstasy on his face at times. At other times, his air of paying attention to something else, like a man counting down time. And yet, what was the point? Did Moff Gitellis really think that he was strong enough to take over the Meridian Sector once quarantine and containment procedures got underway, to hold it in the face of a concerted Republic effort to drive him out? And for what purpose? Pedusis Corios, that nest of smugglers and warlords, would be impossible to control effectively. Djurin's planetary coalition was solidly behind the Republic. Namcorios was a waterless, lifeless rock. To complete the Reliant, Ashgad had said. But she'd seen the Reliant. It was not a planet-killing dreadnought, but a mid-sized freighter. What kind of payload could it carry that would make all this worthwhile, even were the gun stations to be eliminated? The door chime sounded. Lygias entered and glanced at the empty water pitcher. I'm glad you're feeling better, my dear. I couldn't bear to see you killing yourself like that. He didn't quite glance back over his shoulder, but almost. I've changed the combination on the door pad. Zim shouldn't be able to get in here. He made a move to turn away, and Leia caught his sleeve. Who is he? What is he? The dark eyes looked quickly away, and she saw his mouth flinch. He's a native of this world. Leia felt his hand cold under the grip of her fingers. There are no natives of this world. Before the Grismoth started shipping political prisoners here, there was nothing here but stones. What is it he wants with me? Lygias answered quickly. I can't explain. It's something few people would understand. The fear in his eyes was terrible to see. After he had gone, Leia sat for a moment, gathering her breath and her courage. Then she got up, crossed to the dresser, where she kept her gown, the pins, and jewels that had been in her hair. Two of the flat-back jewels from the robe, picked loose, gave her enough purchase to bend the end of one of her hairpins into a makeshift screwdriver. Lock-picking was one of those guerrilla survival skills she'd acquired in her years with the Rebellion, like making explosives out of certain brands of game tokens, or tinkering water filters from sand and flight suit liners. Something simple that might just save your life. An hour and a half afternoon, as far as she could judge from the angle of the sunlight, the lock opened. Leia reached back to feel the comforting hardness of the lightsaber tied around her body beneath her shirt, and stepped out into the hall. Pausing at the foot of the stair, Leia shut her eyes, slowed her breath, and listened deeply to the house. Beldorian's thick voice came from his quarters close by.
Beautiful. All that from just those unprepossessing little gletmites.
And the harsh, nasally whine of the Kuba's chef.
It's all in finding the correct solution, you see, master.
Of Zim, she could hear nothing. She found her way out of the dim curtained quarters of the hut to a door into what was clearly Seti Ashgard's portion of the house, a long chamber that looked out onto the terrace below her own balcony. The monitor screen in the niche above Ashgard's desk was new. Leia pulled up data on the house itself. Wiring diagrams showed her the shaft that led down through the heart of the mesa to the garage from which she'd seen Ashgard's henchmen take an elegant little speeder at dawn. On the other side of the house were the docking bay and its compound of workshops and labs. She ran a print of the house and another on some of the names she'd overheard Ashgard and Zim mention, then folded the sheets of plastic together, stuffed them into the pocket of her trousers, and went to investigate what was behind the slatted doors that rated a separate power backup. It was a CCIR board, the central control unit for synth droids. Leia counted wiring for 24. She continued to make her way through the house until she reached the dark access hatch for the maintenance stair. The blade of her lightsaber didn't give much light, but at least it was better than groping down in utter dark. Something whipped out of sight down the first curve of the flight. The smell of Drox was choking. Then there was a small upright form like a huge Drox on the step ahead of her. It pounced on a particularly gross Drock, catching it in a pincer that seemed to alter in shape and transform into a gulping mouth. For a moment, she heard it purr, a soft little thrum of deep pleasure. Then it swung back, eye stalks swiveling to face her again. Leia extended the lightsaber at the thing. Something dropped from the ceiling, landing on her shoulder with a wet plop. Pain stabbed through her. She cried out and tried to pull it loose. Something else fastened on her leg. She whipped the lightsaber around, shrinking in terror from the glowing blade that she knew could take her own arm off as she touched it to the parasite on her shoulder. It frizzled horribly, and the pain it felt went through her like a knife. And in her dreamy, sickened weakness, she felt it die. She turned the blade and fried the thing on her leg, taking the pain, her strength ebbing with its death. Leia backed up, catching her heel on the stair, clinging to the walls, sobbing, trying to breathe, fighting not to sink into that cool, welcoming sleep that beckoned. She stumbled upward. She fell through the door, lay panting, cold, unable to breathe or think. But in the slow, sinking dimness, she heard movement, the heavy, thick panting of Beldorian, heading her way. She tried to stand, but couldn't. So she crawled through the house. It took everything she had to climb the stairs to her room, where she collapsed on the floor until finally she had the strength to study the printouts she had made. It was all there on the pale green plast. Seti Ashgard's communication with Moff Gitelli's, making arrangements to destroy the gun stations in return for weaponry and first cut of the profits when Lorinar Corporation moved in on Nam Corios to strip mine it for its crystals. Memos from Demura, who turned out to be CEO of Lorinar, detailing which minorities, disaffected factions, and splinter groups would rise in revolt, armed at Lorinar's expense, in order to split the Republic's peacekeeping fleet and allow Gatelli's Admiral Larm to move in. Of the plague, there was little mention. In a memo to Gatelli's, Ashgard said only, "Be assured that it is in my power to completely control the outbreak and spread of this malady, and I offer you my personal guarantees that it will not affect anyone other than those on the Republic ships and bases." And bases, thought Leia, breathless. The Republic was in chaos. They'd poisoned poor Riakin. And for what? Hands shaking, she shuffled through the flimsy-plast pages. There it was. Lorinar Corporation's plan to build a new facility on Antimeridius for the manufacture of both synth droids and something called needles. Programmable, long-distance mini-weapons with infinite range and hyperspace rendezvous capability. Controlled by the same CCIR crystals. programmable. And the source of the crystals was Namkurios. The Reliant. Paperwork was complete on that, too. A modified I-7 Howl Runner hull with extra capacity. Laura and our corporation had been making drops of components and materials for months. Ligeia Sarpatius Vorn was mentioned as the vessel's designer and programmer, but his chief value lay in expert hollow faking. There were requests for specific digitalized scrap of her and of her flagship and escort, to be mocked up into transmissions describing the safe conclusion of the conference between Ashgad and herself, and the two vessels' entry into hyperspace. Her stomach twisted with sick betrayal. The purplish twilight of day was dimming into night when Leia decided to make her escape. She rolled up a blanket and filled a bottle with water. Then she was ready. The door pad combination had been changed while she slept, and she activated her lightsaber and drove it into the innards of the lock. It was now or never. She could afford no delay. Ashgad's study first. She called up the main files, ran a scan and print on everything concerning the Death Seed. Then she paged through the directories until she found what she needed. Maps of the area, elevations, travel guides. 16 kilometers away was one of the gun stations, on a shoulder of the mountains called Bleak Point. She thought she could reach it, keeping to the hem of the foothills for cover. A thought crossed her mind. She opened the slatted doors into the small chamber where the CCIR central control unit stood, amber power lights glowing in the dark. Her hand was on the toggle of her lightsaber when the swish of the outer doors froze her where she stood. Then voices sounded in the room, and she barely had time to pull shut the doors that concealed the control unit. Leia turned one of the slats of the door, put her eye to it. No light had come up in the long study, and the fading daylight outside did not reach to its inner wall. She could make out faces, and she thought Ashgad was wearing a gray or white cap of some sort. Of Zim, she could distinguish almost nothing, save a slumped, dark suggestion of evil, a gleam of eyes. Ashgad spoke, almost too low to hear.
It was a long journey. Look at me.
The old man's voice cracked, and Leia realized that he wasn't wearing a cap, as she had thought. His black hair had grayed almost to whiteness. Zim stepped sideways. Leia saw the black top knot silhouetted against the glint of the computer's power lights and the spidery motion of his hands as he unfastened the breast of his robe. In the gleam of the lights in which he now stood, she saw that below his neck his skin changed. It was hard, shell-like, and all over his bare chest and shoulders were tubes and orifices and groping little mouth nodules that had no business on any human form. These openings gaped and stretched, dark matter running down, glistening. Zim's human mouth opened as well, the long tongue groping like a serpent. With a noise that was not quite a whimper, not quite a sob, Ashgad bent his head down. He pressed his mouth to Zim's chest, and with a horrible movement impossible for a human neck, Zim moved his head around, tongue probing at Ashgad's nape. After a silence of several minutes, Ashgad whispered, "Thank you." The crackle of age was gone from his voice. The room was fully dark now, and only the faintest stain of orange remained in the sky outside. But Leia thought his hair had darkened perceptibly. And when the two left the room, Ashgad moved like a young man. She timed their footfalls, ascending the stair, knowing she had only minutes now. The lightsaber flashed to life in her hand, and she drove it deep into the center of the control unit in a vicious hiss of sparks and smoke. Then she fled. Another door. A synth droid standing in the laboratory beyond, eyes glazed, mouth open as it staggered numbly from wall to wall. Leia brushed past it, and it fell. The storeroom containing the anti-grav units was right where the print of the house said it would be. She grabbed one. The permacrete pad that formed the southeastern quarter of Ashgad's compound overlooked open space on two sides.
The Reliant sat on five short legs close by the door through which she emerged. In smaller hangars to the side, she made out the needle-like nose cone of an elderly headhunter and the blunt silhouette of a gutted skip-ray blast boat. Synth droids lay about like heaps of laundry. Leia went to the edge of the pad and looked down. Her heart froze. It was easily 300 meters to the base of that first sheer drop. From there, the slope tapered steeply, a shamble of diamonds, bled of color in the etiolated light. Behind her, in the dark house, she saw a light go up, then another. The image returned to her mind of Ashgad bending down to the mouths and tentacles of Zim's chest. Leia checked the power on her antigrav unit. It wasn't enough. I'm going to smash to a million pieces, she thought. The night around her, the subtly flashing darkness whispered, "You walls, we're here. Trust." More light sprang up, and then she heard Ashgad call,
"Lygias! Here! At once!"
They found the synth droids. Leia stepped off the edge of the platform.
"Luke!"
Leia was calling him. Luke jolted out of sleep, shocked, breathless in the chilly dawn. The image of her was etched on his mind. She was on a stone terrace, wrapped in a white blanket, cinnamon hair lying in a long, disheveled braid down her shoulder. There was something about the image that told him that this had happened some time ago, that it had been caught up in the distortions of the Force, but he knew it was real. Ashgad. He hadn't just destroyed her ship, looted it for weapons. He'd kidnapped her. Tiselda had said that Ashgad's house was at the foot of the Mountain of Lightning. He reached out his mind.
"Leia, I'm on my way."
As 3PO and R2 looked on, the Chadrafan journalist, Yem Yarbo, took data cubes out of his pocket.
"It's the Lorinar Corporation. On every one of these planets, every place in the Meridian Sector where there's been an armed revolt or uprisings from minority tribes, the dissident forces are always armed with Lorinar weapons. Top-of-the-line blasters and grenades and ion cannons. Look at these."
R2-D2, taking him at his word, promptly extruded a gripper arm, picked up a cube, and withdrew the arm into his own vitals. The three journeyers were in the waiting chamber of the quarantine enforcement cruiser Lycoming. They had escaped from Bagsho on a Gamorrean ship piloted by a Captain Ugmush and her three husbands. Just outside the outlying asteroid fields of the Drovian system, they had encountered a Republic cruiser, Empyrean, firing furiously in all directions without any target immediately apparent, until the flash of one of the cruiser's shield generators blowing up had illuminated what at first appeared to be a cloud of space debris surrounding the vessel like flies. Yarbok, standing at the elbow of the Gamorrean Captain Ugmush and peering back and forth between R2's readouts and those on the console, had whispered,
"No principal ship, just weapons. It's got to be centrally controlled somehow."
With the Empyrean destroyed and the dagger-like little weapons with it, Ugmush had insisted they go back to search for salvage. They were looting the wreck when the Lycoming made its appearance. Its captain, a Gotal female in charge of a small troop of guards and a squad of medics from the Coruscant Institute, had picked up the Empyrean's distress call and was not amused by the presence of the Gamorrean free traders at the wreck site. She had arrested the lot of them. But even as they were brought aboard the Lycoming, Yarbok had had time to inspect the salvage the Gamorreans had pulled out and to seize something of value for himself. As the access hatch in R2's side slid open and his gripper arm deposited the cube on the table in front of Yarbok, the journalist snatched it up.
"Tri-Nebulan will pay me a fortune for that."
At that moment, 3PO was summoned forth to speak to the captain. Prepared to cooperate, he nonetheless found himself looking down the barrels of two blasters and a disruptor. He drew himself up to his full height.
"I am a certified protocol droid, belonging to Her Excellency, Chief of State Leia Organa Solo. She has been kidnapped. You must..."
The Gotal had a weary edge to her voice.
"Her Excellency, my friend, just transmitted authorization for our mission in this sector. I've spoken to her.
She left authorized holograms of herself for contingency purposes before she left on the secret mission. That's standard procedure. But she isn't really there. My counterpart and I are the only ones who know her true whereabouts.
The captain's eyes hardened to steel. Get him out of here. Get that R2 as well. And put that Chadrafan journalist they were with in the airlock. And don't let him out.
Panting, hands bleeding, knees torn, gold ceremonial boots in ruins, Leia shinnied up the wall of the blunt black gun station at Bleak Point. When she reached the top, she crept, exhausted, to the cluster of shielded coils, reflectors, and modulators that rose among the jury-rigged defensive works. The great laser cannons pointed at the sky. Leia cut through the locks on the doors that led to the station below, barricading the doors as well as she could behind her. Hundreds of fingernail-sized drops crawled in the stairway. Some crept purposefully in her direction. Leia activated her lightsaber and flicked them with its tip. Those she touched sizzled and curled into balls of charred death. The others crawled after her as she descended the stairs. The equipment in the station was old but serviceable. Leia flicked the test switches experimentally, studied the readouts. A steel ladder in the center of the floor communicated with the lower level, and she saw that there was equipment there, too. Overhead, boots clunked, and the hard white beam of a sodium light flickered down the opening in the floor. Voices murmured. Leia's cold hands slid over the switch on the lightsaber. A shadow came down two steps of the ladder, then dropped lightly to the floor and stepped at once into shadows. A trained warrior seeking cover. There was movement, and the blade of a lightsaber stabbed into existence. A woman's voice said, "Come out." Leia lowered her own weapon. "Callista?" The blade lowered, and a figure in a red jacket pushed away the veils that wrapped her face. "Leia?" Leia lowered her own weapon.
Callista's strong fingers pulled the roll of silver space tape taut, sliced it, and attached a cutout sole of Koopa leather to the ruin of Leia's boot.
"We are the weapons of the Force,"
she said.
"We always have been, since the beginning of the Order."
The face that had been Cray Mingla's had changed. Look as she might for the features of the young scientist who had given up her body to Callista, that she herself might find her lover on the other side, Leia could see only the lost Jedi, the woman her brother loved so deeply. One of the Therans was setting up a small electro-heater to make supper. The evening wind had stilled. Bay, the troop listener, a twig of a man who might have been 30 or 50, passed like a shadow among the riders, who spread blankets, cleaned weapons, spoke softly among themselves. Callista went on, speaking almost to herself.
"I'm like Luke. I never wanted power, only to learn. But people use those who have our power, Leia. There's a woman in Huaixiol named Tasselda, a small-time Jedi adept who came to this planet centuries ago seeking power."
Leia nodded.
"Beldorian spoke of her. Was he her partner?" "They came here together. They were both adepts, but neither had much power. Only one of them had sufficient training to make a lightsaber, but I don't know which. Like me, they came here seeking an easy answer."
Suddenly sure of it, Leia said,
"You were the slave Lygia spoke of, weren't you? The one Beldorian sold or traded to Zim."
Callista was so silent for so long that Leia feared she'd angered her, but then she nodded.
"Having been Tasselda's slave before, I let myself be enslaved because I was so desperate. She used me, as Beldorian would have used me, had I been any good to him, as he'd have used you. As long as I can be manipulated like that, as long as I lack my own power in the Force, I am a prime candidate for the dark side. I'm standing in its shadow now. If there is a way for me at all, I have to follow it alone. I will love Luke until the day I die, but I will not pull him into that shadow with me. Please, Leia, make him understand."
Against the dry starlight, Seti Ashgard's compound was a matte-black jumble of square shapes, punctuated by minute glowing rectangles of yellow and white light. From the dense shadow at the base of the plateau, Luke stood by the hangar, looking up the cliff face and wondering which one of those lights marked Leia's prison. The lightsaber hummed to life in his hand. From the parking bay, permacrete steps ascended to a landing, then turned out of his view. Cautiously, Luke began to climb. Pain stabbed him in the calf, and he looked down to see half a dozen drops wriggling up his boots. Several had bitten into the flesh already. He fell back, appalled, and something struck him from behind. Pain, like the slice of a chisel, jabbed the back of his neck. He flung himself back against the wall, crushing whatever it was against the permacrete, but as if that had been a signal, the drops on the floor skittered toward him. Weakness flowed over him with the agony of 100 bites, as if all his veins had been opened. This was not blood loss, he knew, but life loss. On the steps ahead of him, Luke saw the biggest drock of all, nearly twice the size of his two fists bunched together, staring at him with two bright eyes on short stalks. And he thought, it's sentient, or nearly so. He cut at it, staggering with weakness. The thing sprang aside, and more flowed toward him from up the stairs and below. He thought, I can't use the force. It will destroy some other place. But when they fastened on him again, stabbing with greedy mouths through the ripped cloth of his suit, panic and horror seized him, and he knew that he must use the force or die. Like a whirlwind, the psychokinetic energy ripped and chopped at them, plucked them up and flung them against the walls, down the steps, and Luke had glimpses of the bigger drops seizing and fastening their mouths upon the smaller, then hurling themselves at him. He directed the force before him and staggered up the stairs, while above him he had the sense of that one huge and sentient drop retreating, watching him with those bright eyes dots, claws clicking on the floor.
What's that?
Leia whirled at something that was less a sound than a stabbing in her mind. From far below in the tower there came a crash. The listener bay caught up a lamp and sprang to the downward leading door. At the same moment, one of the other Therans camped on the roof cried out, pointing. With a shiver, Leia saw one of the grenade launchers rise from where it lay and begin to smite itself against the black shielding of the central gun.
The Force, whispered Callista. Someone is using the Force.
Leia shuddered.
Beldorian?
Maybe. He still has that power, though he can't use it as once he could. That's why he wanted you under his control.
The Force here, could it have done something to him?
Callista shook her head.
Not the Force. Zim and the Drox. They're life drinkers, Leia. They are the Death Seed Plague.
The Grismoths knew. They seeded the planet with Drox, hoping those political foes they exiled here would die. But the light of the sun fragmenting through the crystals generates a radiation that weakens the electrochemical bonds of their tissues.
I don't know how the Prophet Terras knew this, Callista went on. So little is known of him. Certainly he never knew that it was the Drox that caused the plague,
only that no ship large enough to carry heavy shielding should be permitted to leave the planet. He may have been a spy or a politician opposed to the Grismoths, but he understood that the planet must be kept in quarantine. Over the years, that must have extended to forbidding larger ships to land. Somehow, he must have known there was a connection. Leia thought it over. And Ashgard took them out in the flesh of the synth droids. How could he do that? How could he get them past the quarantine screens? How can Zim control them the way he does?
Callista looked at her intently. I can't prove this, but I think the Drox are sentient. After a fashion, they mimic shapes, chemistry, electromagnetic currents, anything down to the cellular level. That's why they can't be detected. I think in some ways they mimic intelligence as well. They become the same substance as their hosts, even as they're drawing the life out of them and into themselves. And the big ones, the Captain Drox, can draw life out of the victims through the smaller ones, without themselves attaching to their hosts. That's when they get dangerous,
The more life they drink, their victims or each other's, the more intelligent they become. The stab of pain and terror struck Leia again, and 100 meters off, the black mouth of the canyon suddenly spewed forth a whirl of dust. No wind stirred, but she saw boulders, slabs of crystal and granite and basalt leap like fish in the maelstrom, and heard the crash of them striking the canyon's walls. Callista sprang to the top of the parapet and stared out across the salt-white wasteland. When she jumped down, her eyes were grave.
That's too big for it to be simply Baldorian looking for you. Something else is going on.
Callista! Pei cried out a warning. At the same moment, wind erupted from below the parapet, pouring out of the canyons all around the gun station. The beams and timbers of the defensive works began to shake, wire and rivets groaning and writhing like live things. One of the flamethrowers began to spout fire. Bay caught it up, hurled it over the parapet, and Leia saw it explode halfway down the face of the tower. While other Therans grabbed metal cable that fell from the beams, Callista knocked ammunition loads and power cores out of every weapon she could lay hands on and hurled them after the flamethrower. A coil of razor wire sprang loose and lashed across Leia's back like a whip as Callista dragged her to the cable the Therans used to climb the tower. Climbing down a cable after having rappelled up only hours ago was the last thing Leia wanted to do. But she felt the force of the horror building, not diminishing. It seemed to her she descended forever with flying boulders shattering against the tower walls and beams and wire raining down past her. How Bay and Callista guided the band to the Koopas and Speeders clustered on the canyon ridge, she didn't know. All the while, Leia could hear Luke's voice, feel his consciousness in the storm. Luke stumbled and let the force around him fade and ease.
She's up there,
he thought.
Or someone who knows where she is.
The stench of Drox washed over him as he neared a door deep in the plateau. Walls, ceiling, and floor swarmed with Drox. A man lay in the midst of the room. He had ceased trying to get up, though he plucked weakly at the squirming things as they covered his face. Luke raised his hand to summon the force again when movement flickered in the doorway on the opposite wall, and a soft voice whispered,
"Now, now, what have we here? Shoo, shoo."
The Drox scuttered from their victim, and Luke slapped the glow rod on his chest to off, concealing himself in the dimness of the room. The man walking toward him from the doorway he recognized as Seti Ashgard's secretary, Zim. Again, Zim whispered,
"Shoo, shoo."
The big, stalk-eyed Drox started to scamper for the doorway where Luke stood, but Zim strode forward and caught it. He pulled off one glove with his small, sharp teeth, and Luke saw that his hand bore only the most superficial resemblance to a human appendage. It was, in fact, a sort of mouth, orifices gaping on the palm and at the ends of the fingers, which Zim fastened around the huge Drox's body. Zim closed his eyes and drew deep his breath. The Drox squirmed, weaker and weaker, and Zim smiled in his reverie. At his feet, the prone man rolled over and tried feebly to rise. Zim put his foot down hard on the victim's chest.
"I thought we had an understanding, Legis. I thought you knew what the boundaries of Seti Ashgard's house were to be. Tell me that you knew."
Legis whispered,
"I knew."
Zim lifted the still wriggling superdruck to his face and chewed at it with his mouth, murmuring and sighing. Ligeus made a weak noise of protest.
"Please, Ashgard, I haven't finished installing the launch vectors."
But Zim was clearly not paying attention. His eyes were shut in ecstasy. Then Ligeus whispered,
"Leia."
And Luke's decision was set. Lightsaber flaring to life in his hand, Luke reached out with the force and pulled Zim from Ligeus, hurling Zim against the wall. But the small man was nimble and swift. He twisted as he struck the wall, mouth parting in a hiss of rage. And for a moment, Luke felt the force used to strike at him in return. Not an expert's blow, not trained, but weakened as he was by the drox, it was strong enough to knock him back against the wall. He caught his balance, sprang forward, and Zim backed away from him, the front of his robe falling open to reveal a squirming mess of tubes and tentacles and secondary mouths. The force smote Luke again, weak and second-hand, absorbed from someone else, he thought. Then Zim was gone.
He'll use the drox who've bitten you.
Luke turned. The man on the floor tried to reach out to him. He continued weakly,
"They're his to command."
Luke knelt at his side. "Where is Lady Solo?"
"Gone. Fled. Looking for her. Beldorian and Ashgard."
Half-dragging, half-carrying Ligeus, Luke descended the stairs, shaky himself and sickened with weakness. In the hangar, Luke dumped Ligeus' unconscious body into the sleek black mob-quit speeder, climbed in himself, and they raced through the night. The Theron riders took refuge in a grotto deep in the hills. For a long time, they heard boulders crashing like pebbles in the surf against the canyon walls. Finally, it was silent. Leia asked softly,
"Who is Zim? He's keeping Ashgard alive, isn't he?"
Callista nodded.
"As he's kept Beldorian alive. He's the key to Ashgard's deal with Lorinar. The key to your kidnapping and poor old Ligeus' ability to cut a perfect holofake. He's the one who could set the drox to drink the life out of the ship's crews at a certain moment and no sooner. He controls them."
Leia shook her head. "That doesn't tell me who he is or how he can do this."
"He can do this." Callista paused. "Because Zim is a hormonally altered, mutated, and vastly overgrown 250-year-old drox."
As the mob-quit coursed over the hills, Ligeus said weakly to Luke,
"Up the canyon. Death seat. Takes less than half an hour."
Luke's breath was beginning to drag hard by the time he halted the speeder, as far up a crevice of crystalline scree as he could manage to ascend. Ligeus regarded him with eyes drunk with fatigue.
"Ground lightning kills them. Rig a jump circuit field through the crystals."
Immediately, Luke began dismantling the speeder's engine. A mob-quit chariot could not generate 1/1000th the power of the ground lightning storms. But once a crude circuit had been wired to push electricity through the huge fragments of crystal that littered the talus slope underfoot, the dim tingling of low-level current was palpable. Ligeus whispered weakly,
"It won't kill the drox, but it weakens them to the point where they can't draw off our energy and transmit it to Zim. When the sun rises, we should be well."
Luke shivered.
"Is she all right, Leia?"
The older man nodded.
"Ashgard forbids him to go near her. He's almost completely enslaved to Zim. But at least until the Reliant was ready, they couldn't let anyone be sure of her fate. Ironic, isn't it, that Zim, who started out life as an appetizer, should..."
Luke stared at him, startled. "As a what?"
"Beldorian's chef, Zubindi, was always experimenting with insects to enhance their flavor. He decided to mutate a drox, and before anyone realized what was going on, it had grown and achieved intelligence."
Ligeus's breath went out in a sigh.
"I kept him away from Leia, from Lady Solo, as well as I could. It's been a long time since I've cared for anything or anyone apart from my own survival. But she was kind and very brave."
The man's voice sank to a whisper again.
"I fear I've left this evil scheme rather late. I was lying to Zim. The program that will take the Reliant out past the gun stations is finished. And the first load of spook crystals is ready to be shipped."
Luke winced, but Ligeus Oblivious went on.
"And crystals are not the only thing it will carry. It will bear Zim to some headquarters where he will not be affected by sunlight. Zim, and as many drox as he cares to take with him, to draw life from others.
And so it will go until he has virtually sucked the life out of half the galaxy.
In the dark of the Transit Galactic Shipping Warehouse on Cyblock 12, a flare of white sparkled. There was a hiss as of an electric welding arm, and the sudden stink of sizzling plastine. Nearby, a muffled voice complained.
Really, R2, if I had known that Master Yarbok's plan to get us to Cyblock 12 consisted of mailing us parcel post...
The droid's adventures had continued. After the Gotal captain of the quarantine enforcement cruiser had had them impounded and the Chadrafan journalist imprisoned in the airlock, R2 had taken matters into his own power core. He directed 3PO to disable the opening mechanism on the airlock and freed the Chadrafan. Then the three fugitives stole a ship belonging to some Aquilish smugglers, whom the Gotal was also questioning. Now the two droids found themselves alone in a dark warehouse. Bodies were strewn about the floor. There was no sign of life. Once again, R2 got to work, hooking circuits and wires, sending 3PO on scavenging expeditions. 3PO protested,
"It's useless, R2. If there's known to be a plague here, no one's going to come near enough to even hear a distress signal."
Still, when R2 gave his instructions, 3PO obeyed. The signal went out in Basic and every one of the 6 million galactic languages in which the protocol droid was fluent.
Help!
Han Solo slapped the comm button on the view screen of the Doran base controller.
What do you mean you can't get a response from Cyblock 12? There should be a half dozen cruisers in port there.
Han and Lando had had a nightmarish flight to the Doran orbital station. Leaving Bagsho, they had run smack into an Imperial invading fleet. TIE fighters had been dispatched. While Lando had dodged and veered the Falcon, Chewie and Han had manned the gun turrets, dispatching two of their pursuers before thick dust clouds and floating chunks of ice discouraged pursuit. Watching the last two TIEs retreat into the distance, Han had remarked, "Either they're too short-handed to risk a scout in this mess, or they don't think we're worth stopping for." Lando glanced at him. "Or they think they got us with that last shot." By the time they walked into the office of the Doran controller, Han was in no mood to be told that no vessels or crews could be released to him from the slender reserves still at the station. The controller faced him.
"Captain Solo, if you please. We have barely gotten the plague isolated on this base. The insurgent faction is equipped with suborbital and supraorbital vessels that have wreaked havoc on this station. This is not the time to strip our forces."
Han spoke slowly, trying to hold down his temper.
"The sector is being invaded."
The controller was inflexible.
"Then why have I not been contacted by either the Chief of State or the Senate Inner Council?"
When she said Chief of State, she fixed him with a dark eye. She knew perfectly well who he was married to. Han drew a deep breath and let it out.
"You're right." Leia always started negotiations by saying, "You're right." "Maybe I'd better see if I can contact the Chief of State on the private channel. It sometimes works better than the military ones."
Han grabbed Lando and hauled him out to the corridor. Quarantine signs were everywhere.
Han whispered, "Does Wingtip Thiel still operate out of Algar?"
"Wingtip?"
Lando looked confused at the sudden introduction of one of their less reputable computer slicer colleagues.
"I think so."
"Can he still slice into the Algar Pleasure Dome's central computer core?"
"Are you kidding? Wingtip could slice into Fleet Central and forge the personnel records of any corporation in the galaxy without anybody being the wiser. But what..."
Han interrupted.
"Get the first ship you can out of here to Algar. Tell Wingtip I need the best holofake of Leia he can make. And this is what I want her to be saying."
Leia and Callista sat apart from the others. Callista spoke sternly.
"You cannot afford to be weak, Leia. You cannot afford to let this kind of thing happen to you ever again."
Leia nodded slowly.
"No, I know that."
Callista stood and unhooked the lightsaber from her belt. The blade slid forth like a lance of summer into winter's dark.
"Then let's begin."
Leia found that sparring with Callista was in some way easier than sparring with Luke. Though Callista was the same height as her brother and was no less exacting a teacher, still Callista understood the differences in technique required of Leia's lesser height and lighter weight, and was far more conscious of distance and timing than any man Leia had ever worked with.
Callista roused a tiny curl of smoke from the rock, a centimeter from Leia's much-taped golden boot.
Footwork. Don't be afraid of your spirit. Don't always be watching yourself.
Leia's breath steadied. The weapon felt more stable in her hands, more a part of herself. Fay came into the circle of torchlight, his scarred, thin face intent.
They're moving on the gun station from Ruby Gulch. Dozens of them. On other gun stations as well.
As Leia and Callista prepared to follow the others to the caves where their Koopas and speeders were hidden, Leia asked,
How did he know that? Voices tell them. Voices that speak in their minds if they sleep in certain places far back in the hills or drink preparations of certain herbs.
Bay is a healer, strong in the Force. Many of the listeners are. Vehicles and animals began their swift trek through the icy darkness of pre-dawn, flowing like water down the silent canyons. For a while, Callista and Leia traveled in silence in an old speeder. Then Callista spoke thoughtfully.
There's a woman in Huegsul who has interests in shipping. When this is over, I'm going to contact her. See if I can get myself off-planet in a cargo lifter and work my passage elsewhere. Are you going to tell Luke you've seen me?
Leia paused. I'd like to. Yes, I think it would be best. Callista nodded.
Make him understand, if you can. Tell him I will love him to the end of my life, but that mine is a life of which he cannot be a part.
Across the crystal ridges, snakes of white lightning flickered in the dawning light. Leia grabbed the railing of the speeder as it rocked and swayed. Glittering crystals at the foot of the cliffs leaped upward like toothed whirlwind. Bay's eyes were shut, listening deeply.
There is one who brings this storm at his will, summons and directs it.
With a droid's infinite patience, C-3PO had been broadcasting his distress call in every language he knew. Finally, he threw his arms up.
It isn't any use, R2. I expect we'll sit here until our power cells run down and chaos and destruction will encompass the Republic. You're right. We did our best. Oh, thank goodness.
3PO pointed to the dark transparasteel where the red track of descending retros had appeared. The two droids stepped through the doorway to see before them an Imperial Fleet Sinar IPB system patrol craft lowering its ramp.
Oh, dear.
A few minutes later, the two droids were ushered into the ship to be brought before the captain. The office doors slid open.
The woman who sat in the room's single chair was tall and athletic in a stripped-down version of the Imperial officer's uniform. Red hair hanging down her back and eyes cold as ball bearings.
3PO identified her at once.
Good heavens, R2. I seem to have been given inaccurate data. According to my most recent information, Imperial Admiral Dalla should be dead.
Dalla said softly, I am.
Han Solo wondered whether there was any insanity in his family. He folded his arms, considering the vista afforded him from the Falcon's viewport. Two CEC gunships, half a dozen smaller cruisers, and twice that many escorts, X-wings, and E-wings. They hung pale and silvery against the darkness of real space. It was true they represented the newest Republic equipment, but all of them, he knew, were understaffed, with men and women pushed to the brink of exhaustion. None of them was a match for what he knew lay ahead. But it wasn't a bad turnout for a fake video and a lot of bluster and fast talk. He turned from the viewport to the main screen, where Lando, who'd hitched a ride back from Algar with the fleet, and his Celestin co-pilot were handling the jump extrapolations. While Chewbacca studied the sensor readouts. Pick 'em up? He asked. Where are they headed? Lando tapped a few numbers.
Well, judging by the point at which they came out of hyperspace, it's Paduceus Corios. Couldn't be Nam Corios, that's just a rock.
Yeah. but by an amazing coincidence, it's the rock city Ashgad comes from. Every entrepreneurial bone in Lando's body was offended to the marrow.
But that's crazy. Who'd want anything on them Curios?
I don't know. But I think we're going to find out. Course for Nam Curios. Possible interception on return to real space, so keep your heads up. Han turned back to the readouts. 3 Star Destroyers, 6 Kariks, 2 Interdictors, and the swarms that didn't even register on the readout. The deadly clouds of CCIR space needles waiting to cut them to pieces the minute they came out of hyperspace. He had to be crazy. Punch it, Chewie. As the Mokrid flew down the canyons, Luke felt the violence of the force storm that surrounded the Bleak Point gun station. Ligeus whispered,
I've never seen it like this, never.
All this so Seti Ashgad can disable a gun station, Luke thought, and create a corridor through which a ship can fly. As they came out of the canyon above the gun station, Luke said softly, They're in. Most of the palisade that had crowned the ancient tower had been torn away by the violence of the uncontrolled force. Luke watched a rusted beam fly from the ground, dragging after it a tangle of wire. On the top of the tower, Rationalist and Theran forces were still fighting. Rationalists struggling to get to the top as raggedly dressed Therans fought them hand to hand to keep them from damaging the gun. Ligeus pointed to a round floater some distance from the base of the walls.
Eldorian's there.
Luke could see the coiled shape of the giant hut on it, muscular and serpentine. Not at all like Jabba's slothful bulk.
What do we do?
Asked Ligeus. Luke began to back the speeder up the canyon again the way they had come.
We hold on tight.
Luke!
Wailed Ligeus, hiding his eyes. The speeder cleared the 25-meter gap between the last ridge of the mountain shoulder and the top of the tower like a necked battle dog. Luke cut the turbos and hit the brake, shouting as he skidded among the combatants who scattered before him.
You've got to stop this. You're being used.
Seti Ashgad only wants to open this planet so Lorinar Corporation can strip mine. He doesn't care about medical supplies or water pumps or machinery for you. Luke looked around at the dusty, bloody faces, the angry eyes, not wanting to believe. Someone said,
Shoot him!
Luke reached forth with the force and pulled the man's blaster awry before he could get the shot off. The bolt of energy scattered chips from the wall of the stairway housing behind him.
He's right!
Behind Luke, the door opened, and Leia stepped through. Grimy in tatters, her hair hanging in her eyes and her palms and knuckles bandaged. She reached into a pocket of the 2 big trousers she wore and produced a wad of computer printouts.
Here's a copy of Ashgad's correspondence, with the CEO of Lorinar, with Moff Gatellis of Antimeridian, with pawns and cat's paws in the Republic Council. Caslow blustered angrily. Which doesn't mean you didn't compose this yourself, girl.
But others were pulling the plast from Leia's hands, reading the memoranda, the deals, the concessions, and becoming incensed.
An installation in Thornwind Valley? 6-month forcible recruitment? A man can't live a week up there.
Mandatory labor pool?
Transfer of material. Isn't a real word for that theft?
Price-free standardization on spooks? At 67 creds?
Occupation fleet? Who said anything about an occupation fleet?
Luke pointed upwards. The occupation fleet is in orbit now. Several of the rationalists had electro-binoculars and focused them skyward, where pin lights of brightness flared. Under the spate of exclamations and curses, Leia threw her arms around Luke in a fierce hug.
What about Zim? Ashgad's...
Luke hugged her. I know about Zim. Leia continued...
If the Council really did manage to get ships to stop Gatelli's fleet, he'll still try to lift off in the Reliant with all the Drox he can bring.
She looked up quickly as Ligeus emerged from the chariot.
Ligeus!
She flung her arms around him, and he returned her embrace.
My dear child, I'm so glad to see you safe.
Luke demanded, Listen, Ligeus, how much does Ashgad know about the software on that vessel? Can he program it? Leia interrupted impatiently.
Of course he can.
Seti Ashgad was one of the top hyperdrive engineers of the Old Republic. The original Z-95s were his design. Luke stared at her blankly.
His design? They were making Z-95s 50 years ago.
Leia continued in a rush. Seti Ashgad is the original Seti Ashgad. Zim's been keeping him alive all these years.
There was a rising clamor, men and women jostling and shoving aside Gurney Kaslow's heated protests of Ashgad's good intent. Sheets of hard copy were flourished in dust and blood-covered hands. The Theran cultists had come down from their defensive positions on the gun shielding to join in the fray. Kaslow broke from the mob, seized a belt of grenades, and scrambled up toward the muzzle of the cannon. Leia yelled, "Stop him!" But was too late. Someone fired a blaster rifle just as Gurney hurled the grenades. A dozen lines of cold light stitched the man like deadly needles. But no one had thought to fire at the grenades he had thrown. And a moment later, a deep, shuddering concussion shook the building. White smoke belched from the cannon mouth.
Leia grabbed Luke's arm. There's an armored headhunter in Ashgad's hangar, and an old blast boat. You can mount the main turret guns in the headhunter. That'll give you enough firepower to bring him down. I'm coming with you.
3PO finished telling his story to the stern, red-haired captain.
Quite honestly, Madam Admiral, that's all I'm able to tell you.
Her voice was harsh. My title is Admiral, droid, not Madam Admiral. I was an officer of the Imperial Fleet.
Her eyes were defeated.
Once, Tarkin and I together could have ruled the Empire. All I seek now is a place to live out the rest of my life where I will not be disturbed. I thought I had found such a place on Pedusis Curios.
3PO's copious data banks contained a great deal of very alarming information about this woman. One of the most brilliant commanders in the Imperial Fleet, but a mad bantha, a loose gun firing at random in battle. A woman of formidable competence and terrifying anger. She asked him now,
"And what do I find?"
3PO had never been good at distinguishing rhetorical from actual questions.
"Invasion? The Death Seed Plague? Wholesale rebellion? Looting?"
"Be silent! I find your vague answers very suspect. Fortunately, many, many years ago, I had a friend who taught me how to communicate with droids."
3PO said with genuine interest, "How very kind of him."
But R2, quicker on the uptake, made a nervous attempt to back away, thwarted by the restraining bolt that Dalla's sergeant-at-arms had taken the precaution of installing on both droids before bringing them into her presence. Dalla hooked a coaxial analysis cable into R2's side and flipped a switch on the analysis kit. Dalla's green eyes narrowed.
"Now, tell me what's happening in the Meridian sector."
Lando flipped through half a dozen data sectors, then cut back to another screen of scan field to check on the next pass of the vicious, needle-like attackers.
"What the blazes are those things?"
Chewbacca yowled something through the comm from the rapidly freezing rear quarter where he was floating near the ceiling to fix burnt-out wiring through hissing masses of emergency foam. Han pivoted the Millennium Falcon through the desperate series of zigzags and loop-the-loops that was the only possible defensive strategy against the strange vessels. Lando's hands flicked over the shield controls.
"Most I can figure is they've got some kind of CCIR technology like synthroids."
Around them, the Republic ships Corain and Fire Eater snaked and wove in a desperate attempt to remain in position near Nam Corios until the actual invading fleet showed up to fight. Stars whirled and flashed past the viewport as Han put the vessel through another series of evasions.
"Are you kidding? You know what a synth droid costs?"
Lando could never leave an explanation unfinished.
"I know that synth droid technology is based on a kind of programmable crystal, and that's what jacks up the price. But if somebody synthesized those crystals or found a way to get them cheap, there's no problem."
"There's a problem for us."
Dalla sat back from the primary readout screen. Grand Moff Gatellis. The screens held the record of R2's long battle to retain the secret files concerning Leia's disappearance and the information Yabok Yem had obtained from the salvage. Dalla spoke to herself in a soft conversational tone.
A quibbling, incompetent, boot-licking little sand maggot. Still has his sycophant larm on a leash, I see. With whom he shared the test results at the academy when he was promoted to captain over my head. Selling out to Lorinar Corporation. A gang of legalistic thieves who'd peddled their sisters to either side so long as they got paid. Slime moles, all of them.
She touched an almost invisible toggle in the arm of her chair.
Yelnor, get me a conference with the captains of all the ships.
Ships? Inquired 3PO, startled.
Ships. I am the president of an independent company of settlers, over 3,000 of us counting spouses and children. We who were loyal to the old ways entered a contract with the warlord Kian for 1.5 billion acres on Paduceus Corius to colonize and to live as we see fit.
She tapped R2 on his domed cap.
And I have no intention of seeing my investment, our investment, come to nothing.
Leia adjusted Aunt Jin's electro-binoculars, wind and dust tearing at her long hair.
He's behind us,
Luke asked. Beldorian? She dropped back down into the sheltered cockpit, began checking loads on the flamethrowers and blaster rifles that Arvid and Yumali Darm had thrust after them on their departure. All bore the Lorinar logo. The hangar doors were locked. So were the doors that led to the stairway up to Ashgad's house. They blasted their way in with ion blasters. Luke and Leia halted in the doorway of the chamber where Luke had rescued Lygias from the life drinker. The floor was a creeping sea of Drox. Brother and sister opened fire with the flamethrowers, swept the whole room in roaring sheets of heat. The gateway that led to the construction compound was locked, and Luke laid a hand on Leia's shoulder as she brought up the ion blaster again. It's shielded. Luke's lightsaber hummed. Leia glanced back toward the blown-out door of the stairway. Luke knew who it was that she felt behind them. He could almost see the hut, ascending each step with a heavy, coiling loop of his great, worm-like body, eyes rubies in the dark. The black hurricane of the Force swirled around him uncontrolled. Luke ran the lightsaber into the lock's works, tested the door switch. It vibrated but held. He peered in. There's another lock behind a wall hatch. Here. Leia had her own blade out. The floor shivered suddenly with the force of liftoff. Luke grimaced. They're off! Over the top of the wall, they could see the square gray shape of the Reliant springing skyward. At the same moment, Leia thrust her lightsaber into the second lock and the door slid open. A couple of spook crystals lay on the permacrete floor of the hangar. There were Drox, two tiny ones, dying in the glare of the pallid sunlight where they had fallen out of whatever shielded container Zim had carried them in. And on the other side of the open bay stood the headhunter, its engine hatch open, a gutted tangle of wires hanging down. Luke swore and raced across to it. Leia was already running toward the blast boat, likewise gutted but otherwise unharmed. Can you fix it? She yelled. They didn't have time to cripple the guns. I think so. Luke began making a fast diagnostic. Get the guns, he yelled from halfway within the hatch. She snatched up an extractor and core couplers and raced across the permacrete to the blast boat. She had dragged one gun over to the headhunter and was starting on a second when she heard the hut's breath. Stertorous, rasping. Beldorian the Splendid moved fast, huge muscle rolling beneath his squamous hide.
Don't test me, little princess.
His own blade stretched forth with a deadly thrumming, a pallid violet.
I may be a lazy old slug now, but I am Beldorian still.
They are struck. Step, step, thrust, as Callista had showed her. A hard, clean slash like lightning, and Beldorian barely got out of the way. But his counter-strike was fast, the strength of it nearly breaking her wrists as she intercepted it on the blade. She stepped back in, pressing him, her attention narrowed to nothing but the monstrous thing before her and the shining blades.
He had enormous striking range, flinging forward like a serpent so that she threw herself sidelong, rolled under the paralyzing wallop of his tail, and was on her feet again, the blade streaming fire from her hand. In and out, Callista had said. It's the only way for a woman to fight. He struck, and she raised her blade to defend, her mind open with the force, feeling that he was going to switch to lateral again. He did, and she was in under the blow, and slashing a long, streaming, sidelong cut that went through the soft green body like burning wire. She flung herself away from him fast, for the huge bulk of him burst open, gouts of fluid and flesh exploding forth, as Luke jumped out from under the headhunter and into its cockpit. She saluted Luke with the blade, and he saluted back, their eyes meeting for an instant, before he slammed the cockpit shut. Luke knew what it was that he saw. Her first victory. The victory over the shadow of Vader. The victory of acceptance of herself as a Jedi. He hit the lifters and the headhunter rocketed into the sky. The headhunter rose faster than the Reliant, faster than most interceptors, for it had been designed to outmaneuver the gun stations. Course controls were adapted to the positions of each gun station. Ligeus' calculations beautifully precise. Luke punched in the program to bleak point, knowing that had to be the way the Reliant was going as well. He saw the gray ship rising far ahead, making for the flurry of explosions and lights. There was a Republic Corsair hanging in space far away to his left, being torn to pieces by tiny darting CCIR needles. The things the Empire wanted. The things Lorinar was going to give them. Beyond, at the farthest range of his vision, he saw the fleet. Imperials, 2, 3 Republic vessels. Was that the Falcon, dodging and twisting, trying to fire at the Imperial ships that were surrounding them? The 1,000 tiny flashes of fire as the needles swirled around them. Luke's thumb hit the firing button. White light glanced forth. The next second, a terrible concussion ripped his ship, tossed it spinning. He glimpsed the Reliant still going on its way untouched, glimpsed something small and fast and black pass over him. Another shot, and his whole console went red. He twisted at the joystick, trying to drag the headhunter to stability, but he was spinning out of control, falling into Namcorius's gravitational pull. He got off a wing laser shot at the Reliant, saw fire explode from her aft engines, but she only drifted off course, and his long-range pickups brought in the faint crackle of Seti Ashgad's voice, calling for an intercept. Luke saw a small Carrick detached from the Imperial fleet begin to make its way toward the drifting craft. Before the Imperials knew what they had loosed, the Death Seed would grow across the stars. The headhunter was falling out of control. The heat in the cockpit was unbearable. He was above an enormous seabed, snaking lines of Tsils marching away into the distance. The 10 cousins. Other circles, other lines pointing towards the great glittering outcrops of spooks in the hills. There was a pattern to them, visible only when coming in from above like this. Luke pulled back on the joystick as hard as he could, threw his mind open to the force, and brought her in. Afterwards, he didn't remember getting out of the headhunter before it exploded. He knew he'd probably used the force to damp physical reactions until he'd crawled to safety. And then he remembered the pattern of the Sills. The listeners said the rocks spoke to them. Luke thought, "You're alive." Luke passed his thoughts to the Sills, more amazed than he'd ever been in his life. Ascent flowed over him. Alive, alive, like an echo. "All this time," they agreed, "thinking and dreaming and speaking and singing. The sea formed us, and the sea went away.
The planet fed us from the fires of her heart. Little people here and there, but not important. Not until they took us. Took our...
The word was impossible to translate in his mind.
Brother self,
he thought. A part of their minds. The deep tide of their anger flowed over him. Anger for their kidnapped kin. Taken. Zapped with the horrible electronic realignment so that they became slaves. Luke sensed the incomprehension of those slow, timeless beings about what it was that they saw. But he understood. And then his consciousness was in the cabin of the Reliant. Two synth droids lying dazed on the floor, their flesh a rotting mass, but their minds receiving impressions. Siti Ashgat sat at the controls, his face bleeding, his hair, his clothing, his body crawled with drox. And Zim stood behind him. Zim, with his robe open to the waist, every pulsing orifice and squirming pendule moving.
Reliant?
Crackled a voice over the comm system.
This is Grand Admiral Lahm of the Anti-Meridian Sector.
Luke was so startled by the vision that he could barely gather his thoughts. The Tsils could see this, but could not understand. A second vision flashed in his mind, of the Reliant rising against the great purple-white gem of the planet seen from space, of the Kariks drawing closer to it, and, weirdly, of the voices transmitted between them, picked up over the electronic consciousness of the needles themselves, and relayed back to their kindred Tsils.
This is Grand Admiral Lahm of the Anti-Meridian Sector Imperial Fleet. In the name of Grand Moff Gatellis, I am empowered to greet you personally.
Luke said to the crystals,
focus through me.
He felt their awareness converge on his. The force in them twined with the force within his bones and flesh and mind.
Tell them to destroy Ashgat's ship.
He reached out his mind to those hovering, darting consciousnesses in the black gulfs of space.
Do this for me. And I swear to you, wherever they are, they will be brought back here.
He felt the consultation of them like an endless wave spreading out across the planet. And then it came back, force and more force, shining currents of it streaming through his body, unbearably bright. He saw Seti Ashgat trying to get to his feet, stumbling and falling among the synth droids that littered the floor. Saw Zim draw in a breath of ecstasy, of world-devouring delight. Luke's eyes were closed, so he didn't see far above him in the blue, unchanging sky the tiny brightness of an explosion. Then he fainted and lay unconscious beside the slow-rising pillar of oily smoke in the midst of the wasteland of light. Given the circumstances under which they had last parted, the shuttle journey down to the surface of Namkorios could not be other than awkward for Han Solo and Admiral Dalla. C-3PO, who accompanied them with Chewbacca, R2-D2, and a considerable number of Dalla's co-emigres, did his best to ease the tension by filling Solo in on recent events. But everyone was at a loss to account for the fact that those supposedly programmable space needles had unexpectedly left off attacking the small Republic fleet and had descended upon the gray ship rising from the planet's surface, blasting to eternity both it and the Imperial Carrick that had gone out to tow it to the safety of the Imperial fleet. Even as the debris cloud of the Reliant and its escort was dispersing, the entire squadron of space needles had turned and swirled down into the atmosphere, heading for the surface of the planet. Dalla glanced over her shoulder at Han.
From the time I was 16, the fleet has been my life. And now, this.
Han raised his eyebrows.
Well, I can understand you're not the only one who's ever been betrayed.
She started to jeer something back at him, then stopped herself.
No, perhaps not.
The homing beacon from the surface brought them to the Bleak Point gun station, where the plane of crystal made a landing area for the shuttle. Wreckage from the force storm scattered the gravel for half a kilometer around the walls of the tower. Snarls of wire, broken beams, weapons burst by the violence of Beldorian's uncontrolled will. Rationalists and Therans alike were gathering around the walls, and the plane was a parking lot of speeders, speeder bikes, and Koopas, warbling and wheezing and scratching themselves. From their midst, two figures broke away, crossing to Han and Chewie at a run. Leia threw herself into Han's arms. "Admiral Larm," she began. Han finished for her. "Is space dust. His fleet went back to Anti-Meridian to give him a nice memorial service. I don't think they're going to be back."
"You know what happened?"
"Pretty much. The plague's over three-quarters of the sector. There doesn't seem to be any way of stopping it. The boys at Med Central say it's like the Death Seed..." Luke came over to them, limping heavily on a stick. "It is the Death Seed. The Guardian Sills have agreed to send some of their number off-planet to the sector medical facility to be installed in apparatus that will destroy the Drox. All they ask in exchange is that we return every spook crystal that has ever been taken off and programmed." He went on, speaking softly. "They knew about the Drox. They were aware when the Grismoth dynasty ceded the planet with them to kill its political prisoners. They did their best for 7.5 centuries to keep the Drox from getting off planet. They invaded the dreams of the prophet Theris and his followers and instructed them to keep anything larger than a B-wing from taking off. Anything bigger would have had sufficient shielding to protect the Drox from the radiation. And there are seams of mineral wealth deep in the mountains that can be exported in small enough quantities to be ray-screened and still support those who take them off." Umali Darm approached with Arvid and Ah Jin.
"Which is just fine with me. I never liked that spook business. Too fragile. The ones with good color were too far back in the hills, and even a box or two of those things gave me the willies. That Theron Bay is already putting together an expedition for Rock Ivory with me and Arvid here."
They hurried on their way, Arvid waving back at Luke. Leia glanced in the direction of the shuttle and Admiral Dalla, and then back inquiringly at Han. He grinned. "An old friend. Dalla showed up at the last minute to help out. She wants a diplomatic discussion and some assurances from you." Luke turned to follow his sister and Han to the shuttle. At least he'd have a reason to get up in the morning, he thought wryly. He would come back to this world, to bring back the remains of the synth droids and space needles, to be realigned by the Guardians. A Theron was rappelling easily down the walls of the gun station, crimson coat and gray veil striking a familiar chord. The fighter who had thrown the grenades at the speeder, thought Luke, during that first battle he had seen. When the gawky, graceful figure reached the ground and walked toward Umali Darm's freighter, he saw the lightsaber swinging at the heavy leather belt, the long malt-brown hair as she pulled loose her veils, and his heart leapt. She turned at the freighter's ramp. She had always known if he was looking at her. For a long moment they stood in stillness. He raised his hand to her.
"Farewell."
Her shoulders relaxed, and he could feel the tension leave her, the fear that he would cross that open ground to tear anew all those fresh wounds by taking her in his arms. The time was past for that. In her stillness, he read her thought.
"Please, understand."
"I understand." She raised her hand to him, and he could feel her smile. Luke was at Ligeus's heels when they stepped into the forward lounge, and the red-haired woman seated near the viewport rose from her chair and turned to Leia.
"Your Excellency?"
But she said no more. She only stood transfixed, color draining from her face. It seemed to Luke that there was another face looking out from those bitter emerald eyes, a girl's face.
In a whisper, Admiral Dalla said, Legius? Legius was staring as if at a ghost. Only no ghost could have brought such joy to a man's face. Dalla? They crossed to each other, stopped inches apart, as if after a lifetime of diverging paths, they feared to touch. Have you... Ligeia's voice hesitated. Have you had a good road all these years? A long one, cruel in places. You? Yes, a long road too. She put her hand to his face. I've missed you, Ligeia. Their lips met, afraid at first, then drinking deep as if they could never again have enough. No one in the lounge was the slightest bit surprised when Dalla and Ligeus made their exit without a word to anyone. Han drew Leia down beside him on the black leather couch. I guess you'll have to have that conference some other time. From the viewport, Luke watched the thin yellow track of Yumali Darm's freighter as it lifted from the planet, streaked through the atmosphere and away. She's all right, he thought. It was like watching a hunt bird when, after years of servitude, its owner frees it to return to the woods. She is well and strong. She'll find her way one day to the Force, to the light. He felt at peace and strangely free. She had released him, he thought, to travel his road, wherever that road was going. He heard a soft step behind him, knew it was Leia before her hands touched his shoulders. Her voice was worried. Are you all right? Yes. I'm all right. This is Anthony Heald. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Planet of Twilight by Barbara Hambly. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Hoel. Abridgment by Trevi Johnson. Planet of Twilight is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1997, all rights reserved. The book Star Wars, Planet of Twilight is available wherever Bantam books are sold.